You think it's fair. This is a democratic process. We should be able to get rid of it.
It's a function of age. When you get to a certain point,
it's class envy now.
I'd like to convene the Senate Interim Committee on Healthcare, Human Services, and Rural Health Policy, and just to make a statement, Senator Mona Sanderson is joining us by phone and computer from Arizona. She was going to come up for this meeting, but this is her first Grandma Christmas, and I forbid her from doing that. There are important things, right, Senator?
Thank you, Jim.
Your first Christmas as a grandmother should be very special, and I didn't want her wasting 3 days. So she's with us here, and we are convened.
I now call to order the House Interim Healthcare Committee, and welcome other members of the legislature with us at the panel today. And I will call the first panel. We have a couple of announcements to make as the first panel is gathering. Bruce, you want to? Yes, ma'am. Oh, there's an overflow room right next door, hearing room E. And the handouts are available. Is that right? Why don't you talk to us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Just want to, as the good co-chair mentioned, overflow room is hearing room E. And for any people that are handing in testimony or handouts, please bring it over to the gates that are by the entryway, not to the other end of the dais. It's just easier to maneuver. And also for folks on the phone, not only please identify yourself when you begin your testimony, but every time you speak, just give us your first or last name so we know how to document the discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Have a name tag, Eugene.
Likes to make a scene.
Good. Great. Dr. Goldberg, go for it. You've got, we promise you 20 to 30 minutes uninterrupted, so you can MC your show, and then we'll have at you.
I look forward to that. I see Bruce looking at me, so I'll begin. I'm Eric Parsons from Portland, Chair of the Oregon Health Policy Board. Good morning, chairs and members of the committees. I want to start by, acknowledging you guys really know how to get into the spirit of the season. Thank you for the opportunity to share this with you. Very seriously, thank you very much for your time today. We all know we're working on a very important topic and one that's complex and in need of good scrutiny, and we really do appreciate your willingness to take time during this busy time of year to help us work through some of the issues we're working on. I will let the others introduce themselves as their turns come up, but I just want to start by kind of laying the groundwork and reminding everybody that we're essentially here today to bring to you in response to House Bill 3650, the response of the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Health Policy Board. We've been here before. I'm sure we'll be here again, but we simply want to start by reminding everybody in the room that it is our intent as set forth in House Bill 3650 to be back to the legislature with deliverables that were set forth and required. Those include draft legislative language for the implementation of coordinated care organizations. We'll talk about that in a minute. The proposal for CCO implementation will include CCO qualification criteria, global budget methodology, savings models, financial reporting requirements. We're also here today to talk about medical liability and cost containment strategies, alternative dispute resolution process, financial models to demonstrate feasibility of our cost savings. All those will come up in one way or another. I want to start by pointing out that the draft of the implementation plan that all of you have, I believe, received a copy of is just that. It's a draft. It came together in basically the public process that was envisioned by House Bill 3650. We've had a number of meetings of the Health Policy Board. We've had a number of public meetings throughout the state. We have had input opportunities from a wide variety of folks, and good ideas are coming to us. A lot of what's in the implementation plan is built right out of the language of House Bill 3650, and that's as it should be. But we're certainly in the process of trying to get together the necessary details and so on, so that this will all come together in an organized way. Another point that I want to make is that the draft that's in front of you and which we'll be talking about really has a number of audiences. Clearly, it needs to work for all of you. It needs to work for the folks who are in the process of forming CCOs and will be delivering health care to members of the Oregon Health Plan. It also will be a document that will be very important to the federal officials who will be reviewing our request for waivers. Remember that without the waivers, we can't implement most of what we're trying to accomplish, and so we're trying to make sure that we create a document that is responsive to all of those audiences. I want to talk just a little bit about the timelines that we're involved with, and then we'll get into some of the other meat of today's event. We essentially are pleased to be here today for this interim hearing. The Oregon Health Policy Board has a meeting on January 10th, at which we'll be considering in great detail the contents of this draft and a lot of public input that is coming our way during what is now going on, a public comment period. After the January 10th meeting, there'll be another public comment period, and we'll have another meeting on January 24. We'll revise the draft probably once again based on that input and input we received today and from others. By February 1, we'll have the proposal back to the legislature, and then assuming that we've got something that is approvable by the legislature, we'll begin the implementation process. We'll file our request for waivers with CMS and so on, with a goal of being ready to go by July of 2012 with the first of the CCOs. Keeping us on track is going to be important today, and so I'm going to turn it over quickly to Bruce to introduce the topic of medical liability and introduce folks on the phone. Bruce?
Thanks, Eric. For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. One of the deliverables is Section 16, which outlines a number of pieces that we need to bring back to the legislature. It requires a study and recommendations for legislative and administrative remedies that will contain health care costs, and it directs the agency to explore the cost benefits and impacts of defensive medicine and several types of reforms. It's complex work. It's work that we've hired several national experts to work on and report back to you. They're on the phone today, and I'll introduce them in a moment. What I just would comment on is that they're in the process of, they're in the middle of their work right now. And so there's not going to be anything very substantive to report on in terms of recommendations. They'll let you know how they're approaching this and what they're doing. And then we'll be back in January with a more completed report and some recommendations. We have four experts, one from here in Oregon, Dr. Bill Wright, from the Providence Center for Outcomes Research, and three from Boston and the Harvard School of Public Health. Dr. Kate Baker, who's a world-renowned economist, Dr. and J.D. Alan Kachalia, and Michelle Mello, Ph.D., J.D., who are all at the Harvard School of Public Health. And they're going to just talk a little bit as to where they are, and then they will be available throughout the 2 hours allotted for our time this morning to answer any questions. So let me first turn things over to Drs. Wright and Baker.
Hi, this is Bill Wright. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep, just fine.
Great. Well, I'll get started and then I'll turn things over to Kate for the second part of it. I just wanted to thank you for making some time for us, and I was thinking I would just take a couple of minutes to give you an overview of what we're doing on this part of the project. And we were asked to use Oregon-specific data to do a couple of things for you. One was to estimate the overutilization and the total cost of defensive medicine in Oregon, and then to do some analysis around what the key drivers of those costs are. And that's a piece that Kate Baker and I are working on together. And there's a couple of approaches that we're taking to that. The first thing we're doing is a survey of about 2,500 actively practicing physicians in Oregon, and I'll tell you a little bit about that part. And then the second thing that we're doing is using some Oregon administrative claims data from the All Payer, All Claims database to produce cost estimates around defensive medicine. And I'll turn it over to Kate, and she can tell you a little bit about that part of what we're doing. So let me just give you a sort of a one-minute speech about the surveys. I think doing some surveys is a really important part of this, since if you want to go on, know what's going on in defensive medicine in Oregon, you should probably talk to people who practice medicine in Oregon. But one of the things that I think any survey person will tell you is that it can be pretty tough to get good survey data when you're asking about things that people have strong opinions over or big stakes in, and so we really want to get the best data that we can.
Can I interrupt this moment?
Okay. Oh, sure. Is that Mitch?
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure you had introduced yourself at the beginning.
He did.
Okay.
I think we're good. Are we good?
Yes, we're good.
Okay, great. So we're taking a couple of approaches to just get the best survey data we can get. And the first thing that you generally do with these kind of surveys is, instead of just asking about opinions, you try to ask about events. You try to ask about things that are objectively measurable for people. So in our case, we're not just out in with a survey asking physicians about their opinions on defensive medicine. We're asking physicians to tell us how often they ordered certain types of tests and procedures that weren't clinically indicated because of fears about medical malpractice. We're asking about how often things have happened so that we can actually try to come up with some quantifiable estimates around what kind of overutilization we're talking about. Now, I think it's natural if you're a critic of surveys, or just in terms of a scientific criticism, to say that it's going to be natural to inflate those sorts of estimates if you're talking about an issue that's really important to you, and you may not get the best data, even if you try to ask about things that are objectively measurable, events or behaviors. And I think that may or may not be true in the case of the survey that we're doing here, but it's a valid criticism from a scientific standpoint. So I think it's also important not just to ask about things that are as measurable as possible in an objective way, but to have something to calibrate the estimates against once you get them. And so what we've done on the survey is, first of all, we ask our physicians about how often certain types of tests and procedures were ordered, even though they weren't clinically indicated, and we have a survey about defensive medicine in which we do that. But then we have another set of physicians that we're asking the same questions to about the same tests and procedures, but on a different survey, a survey that's about the overall cost effectiveness of healthcare and not about defensive medicine in particular. So we're asking about the same sets of objectively measurable behaviors, but in a couple of distinct contexts. And the reason we do that is not because one context provides a more correct answer than the other one, but the reason we do it is so that the results from the surveys have a chance to validate each other. We were asked to produce estimates on how often different types of overutilization are happening. And so if we see big differences between the results of the two surveys, then we know that the context within which we asked the question really impacted our estimates, and we try to adjust the estimates accordingly. And if we don't see big differences, then we feel that much more comfortable with the quality of the estimates that we're providing you from the survey data. So that's basically our approach to the survey. We've got about 2,500 surveys. We're collecting the data right now. We're doing pretty well in terms of getting them in, and by the time you guys meet again, we'll have some findings for you about what physicians are telling us is happening around the issue of defensive medicine in Oregon. The other thing that we're doing is not just relying on surveys. We're using claims data to try to get at the cost estimates from another direction as well. And I think I'll turn it over to Kate, and maybe she could give you a quick overview of our approach on that one.
Hi, this is Kate Baker, and as Bill said, we're collecting direct evidence from surveys from physicians about their interaction with the healthcare system, but to complement that, we're using the newly available All Payer, All Claims database to look at specific spending patterns in Oregon, and then to apply national estimates or scientifically valid estimates of the degree of defensive medicine in each of those contexts that are drawn from more sophisticated statistical methodology. And I certainly won't go into the detail of the methods of those studies that we're going to draw on, but the common characteristic is that it's hard to figure out what number of tests were really due to malpractice fears versus due to the test being necessary, or what share of procedures can really be attributable to the medical malpractice system. And a number of national experts, including Dr. Mello, who's on the phone today, have taken some sophisticated statistical approaches to try to really disentangle what share of utilization in this category of care can we say is reasonably attributable to the defensive medicine, the practice of defensive medicine, or to the medical liability system. We're going to draw on that broad literature, but then apply it to the very specific spending patterns that we see in recent years in Oregon using that database that'll let us break down different types of services, such as imaging or cesarean sections or, you know, other areas of care that seem particularly susceptible, and also looking across payers so we can see what share of that is being paid for by public programs like Medicaid versus private insurance, et cetera. And those estimates, I think, will really complement the survey results that Bill's survey is generating to paint a complete picture system level of the extent of defensive medicine, and that then will feed into the next part of the analysis that I think Michelle will talk about, looking at different reforms. I'll stop there.
Okay. We can move to... can we ask questions?
We were going to try and hold them, if that's okay, till
the end.
Yeah,
let's try and go through the 30 minutes, and then we'll...
Then, why don't we go to Drs. Mello and Kachalia?
Hello, this is Michelle Mello. I'm an attorney and a health services researcher, and I'm a professor of law and public health at the Harvard School of Public Health. Alan Cattelli and I are working on analyses of five different proposed reforms: caps on non-economic damages, medical panels, extensions of the Oregon Tort Claims Act to include providers when they're providing care to a patient who's covered by a coordinated care organization, clarifications or modifications to the state's existing joint and several liability statute, and administrative compensation systems. I'm going to talk briefly about the damages caps analysis, and then Dr. Cachalia will talk about the other analyses. The general approach that we're taking is to, as Dr. Baker talked about, draw on the strongest available estimates of the effects of some of these reforms in the scholarly literature, and then combine that with the available data about costs and claiming in Oregon. So we'll first begin by laying out the theoretical benefits of damages caps, which are both direct and indirect, and these include effects on indemnity payments, which are what the insurance companies are paying out to plaintiffs, insurance premiums, settlement rates, the frequency or number of claims, defensive medicine, and the supply of physicians in the state. We'll then critically review the available literature on each of these topics. It's a large literature, and there's a lot of good and a lot of bad studies. We'll be separating out the strongest evidence from the evidence we feel should be discounted or disregarded. And we'll then use the best available estimates of the magnitude of these effects from the published literature, as well as some data we've obtained from the Oregon Medical Board, National Practitioner Data Bank, Medical Liability Monitor, and the Insurance Division, on indemnity payments, premiums, and physician supply in Oregon to estimate the likely effects of these reforms in Oregon. For the defensive medicine analysis, we'll simply defer to the work that Drs. Wright and Baker are doing. There will be a moderate amount of uncertainty around the estimates that we're going to be generating, and that's because we anticipate that most of the effects of damages cap will be indirect. There are actually very few awards in Oregon that result from a jury verdict, and a cap on non-economic damages only formally applies in most cases to jury verdicts. It has informal effects, however, on settlements, because the parties know that they are bargaining in the shadow of this cap that would apply if they went to trial. But when you're modeling those effects on settlements, you know, you're making some assumptions about how people will behave under those conditions rather than modeling how that the law formally affected claims that were disposed of by a judge or jury. What you can expect from the report is some estimates of how premium prices for malpractice insurance might have been different in the shadow of caps of varying levels, and I expect to be modeling caps at the $250,000, $750,000, and $1.7 million levels. How we might expect to see changes in the number of claims brought, changes in the average award on claims, as well as total indemnity payments in the state, and finally changes in physician supply. The report will also include a discussion of the cost or adverse effects of caps, which include reduced access to the legal system and exacerbation of some existing inequities in awards. For this, we'll have some data on the information about which types of plaintiffs tend to be most affected by caps. And we'll conclude by summarizing the findings and making some recommendations about how the state might think about proceeding with respect to caps. With that, let me pause and turn it over to Dr. Cacciaglia to talk about the other work.
Wonderful. Thank you, Michelle. So my name is Alan Cacciaglia. I'm a physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston. I practice as a general internist in hospital medicine and also oversee our quality and safety initiatives for the hospital. And I have the privilege of working with Michelle Mello at the School of Public Health and conducting some research in liability-related matters in medicine. So what I'll do is Michelle's covered CAPS. So what I'll do is I'll just give a quick update on what we're doing on the other four reforms that are being considered, as well as some preliminary findings and issues that we've identified. So the first one is extending the OTCA coverage, the Oregon Tort Claims Act, coverage to providers when caring for Medicaid patients that are in a CCO. So what we've preliminarily found is that assuming that this coverage can be legally extended, and the DOJ is looking into that, this incentive turns out may not be as effective for participating physicians unless the protections can lead to actual premium reductions. Because if without changing the insurance structure, most of the compensation and defense cost savings may end up accruing to insurers. Secondarily, it appears that we may also need more clarifications on how the OTCA protections would result in claims reporting requirements for providers. With regard to the second item, which is clarifying potential joint and several liability-related issues that might arise from the implementation of coordinated care organizations, we assume that the concern here will come from just greater joint liability concerns that people will have from the greater numbers of providers that will be now practicing together in networks. And this is what's asking for people for some clarifications around this. From our preliminary look here, it turns out the clinical risks of joint liability shouldn't be very different than it is under other models today. That said, we're going to continue to finish our analysis. And the other thing to remember in Oregon, which we've learned, is that since most providers tend to carry liability coverage, JSL concerns become less important if the other defendants tend to be solvent and able to pay their share of the judgment. With regard to the third reform, medical panels, whether they're binding or not, what we're going to do is we're going to draw on the empirical evidence of medical panels, or pre-trial screening panels, as they're known. We'll draw on the empirical evidence on how they've done in other states, especially with regard to how well they perform their theoretical functions, which is helping lower claims frequency, speeding claims resolution, or lowering premiums. Of note, medical panels may also raise constitutional issues in Oregon as well, especially binding panels, and the DOJ is looking into that. And then last but not least, we're also looking at administrative compensation systems. Here we're working on a report that will provide information on the costs and benefits and whether a net savings would arise from the implementation of an ACS in Oregon, describing how an ACS could help improve patient safety, describe the compensation effects that could result from it, and whether or not a system like this would work better if it was opt-in, opt-out, or mandatory. There's obviously no empirical evidence what ACS is for medical injury in the United States, so we'll be drawing on systems from New Zealand, Sweden, and Denmark, as well as a lot of empirical work on how well the U.S. liability system performs here to lend final recommendations. And with that, I'll turn it back.
Okay. mindful of the time, we're going to move forward from there. I believe we'll have opportunities for questions and comments shortly, but I want to go back to the implementation plan and, again, remind everybody this is an early draft subject to change as we receive lots of additional input from the public and other sources. Within the implementation plan, there are really three topics that we want to address very briefly. I've got a couple of comments about governance, and I'm going to ask Lily and Shirley to add some information about the policy board's thinking on global budget and accountability. With regard to governance, a lot of the governance structure was well defined in House Bill 3650, and certainly the policy board has no interest or desire in trying to change that. I think if I left you with one thought, some of the feedback that I've heard has been in the form of concern that that perhaps the policy board has an interest in being relatively more strict in the governance standards than is probably the case. I think that our real goal here, excuse me, is to recognize that the governance structure, as with most other rules and regulations of the CCOs, really need to recognize that we're trying to be local and flexible. And so what we're going to do, obviously, is recognize that HB 3650 requires that the majority of the board of the CCO be consist of people who are carrying the financial risk. We recognize and agree with that. We do believe that it would make sense for at least one member of the Community Advisory Council to probably serve on the governing board and make sure that the advisory council's recommendations are heard and responded to. And we also note that 3650 encourages partnerships between the CCOs and other local mental health authorities, county governments, and so on. And we want to make sure that as we create our criteria, we understand how the CCOs do intend to fully embrace all of those other organizations and include meaningful partners with them. So those would be the focuses of governance as we're concerned. Again, flexibility is, in our minds, really the key. We know that the solution that works in Roseburg or Medford is not going to be the solution that works in Portland, and we're trying to make sure there's plenty of room for everybody to fit. With that, Lillian Shirley.
Thank you, Eric. I'm Lillian Shirley, and I'm the Health Department Director for Multnomah County and Vice Chair of the Oregon Health Policy Board. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to get feedback from all of you as we move forward on our process of developing this concept. One of the primary goals of the global budget and the concepts in the paper is to allow CCOs, as Eric said, flexibility. But the flexibility really needs to be addressed to invest in the care that may decrease cost and certainly achieve better outcomes given the local conditions around the state. So the more programs and services and funding streams that are included in the CCO global budgets and the more flexibility and room for innovation that will exist in the CCOs. So we're looking for, again, our goals are comprehensive and person-centered care. So it leaves necessary care outside of the budget. We discussed this at great length at the last meeting. It would really create conflicting incentives where the action of the payers outside of the CCO who have really little reason to contribute to the efficiencies may have undue impacts on the cost and the outcomes of those providers within the CCO. And an example of that, I think, would be non-emergent medical transportation. So, you know, if you can call an ambulance and it gets paid for to go back and forth, and it's not in your global budget, you might not have any incentive to look at some of the innovations that people are talking about in terms of community-based care, peer support, home visiting with peers and outreach workers, as well as telephone connections. So that's kind of an example of what we mean when we say there would be incentives that would disincentivize real innovation. So to that end, the board discussed a number of recommendations. First of all, that all Medicaid dollars be included in the CCO budget with, of course, the exclusion of the Medicaid-funded long-term care and the mental health drugs, which are called out in the legislation that you all passed last session. So that the people that would be enrolled would be all the Oregon Health Plan Plus, the CHIP program here in the state, the Oregon Health Plan Standard, and those who are fully eligible for both Medicaid and Medicare. Without exception, we see the funding and the responsibility for all current services provided by managed physical and mental health organizations, as well as as I used as an example, non-emergent transportation would be included in the CCO's global budget. We also recommended at this point to include in the draft concept that we would tie the budgets to a fixed rate of growth rather than medical inflation, so that the cost increases can then, and the impact of those cost increases would be slowed down, so that they're not outpacing the revenue, which is what we see today. And that initial budgets, our recommendation is, should be established for 1 year, and that would be the first year. And then, once again, that we would have some experience, because, you know, we're in uncharted territory, have some experience, have the Oregon Health Authority and the stakeholders in the CCO areas come back together and explore the possibility of agreeing and establishing global budgets that could be enacted on a biennial or a multi-year basis. So this would give us a chance to provide a way that and that the CCOs could get a sense of, you know, what, how can they evaluate what seems to be the spending trends and how the dollars are being allocated within a global budget. So the other area that we've had a lot of discussion and a lot of feedback on, and it, you know, it's all on the website, you know, you can, you know, it's all posted on the Oregon Health Authority website, is the area of accountability. And the challenge will be, you know, as we've said before when we've spoke to you and as Eric reinforced, the challenge is really figuring out a way to balance local flexibility and accountability. The board discusses in a great amount of detail and received a wide variety of input last time we met. And we'll also revisit this issue again January 10th. So we'll have this period of public comment and input between the last December meeting and the January 10th meeting to inform as well. You know, one of the challenges that we face, everybody wants flexibility and as much flexibility as possible, except on what they want to be prescribed, you know, in there. So we're constantly trying to find this balance of accountability and flexibility. House Bill 3650 directs the Oregon Health Authority to develop a set of metrics that would be included in the contracts that any entity that wanted to be a CCO or apply for it would have to report on. We've had a quality outcomes and efficiency work group that was created. As you all know, we had 4 meetings. We had a lot of volunteers to be on it, and we had some of the best minds in Oregon kind of debating and struggling with these issues around this. And they developed a set of principles that are very thoughtful, very comprehensive, and measurement domains, and then some examples of what would be specific metrics. This is very heavy lifting, and the board would like to recommend that the next step be to establish a technical work group with responsibility for developing a core set of metrics pending the legislative approval that would be based on those domains and those principles that these work groups identify. And then the second area, which is really very important to everyone on the Oregon Health Policy Board, is how do we really meet your charge to be accountable to the community, and how do we structure our proposal to really reflect that? So the recommendations thus far are that CCOs partner with their local public health authority and their hospital systems, and they develop a shared community needs assessment that really focuses on health equity issues and health disparities in each community. So we have a transparent document that everybody has agreed to how to go about it, and then hold that to say, this is the baseline, these are the conditions in our community, and then the community could also see how well a CCO is meeting the needs of moving the needle on those issues that were raised in this joint community assessment. So the other thing that this does, that it helps us to focus on the health equity issues and the health disparities as they are different in different communities across the state. And this process, we also feel, will contribute to are charged to really work toward administrative simplification. And an example of that is by doing this type of process, we would be combining what is currently three separate state and federally required community needs assessments that are being done by providers, hospital systems, and local communities in their areas. The other area that we've spent a lot of thought on how to implement is the recommendations or the legislation where it talks about the advisory council and the advisory council structure. We see this is also a really important piece of the accountability to the community going forward. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Goldberg to discuss the issues in the draft plan around financial analysis.
Thanks. Briefly, I think everybody has a copy of the 34-page proposal, and so there's certainly much more detail about the governance, the accountability, the budget, et cetera. One thing that isn't in here, which I just wanted to touch on briefly because it's coming, is an analysis of the opportunities for cost reduction. There's been a number that we put together about a year ago now. $239 million of state funds, which really is about $600 million of total funds with the federal match. And what we're doing is having an outside group of experts really look at what that opportunity is. Is it 239? Is it 229? Is it 189? Is it 279? I think the issue is that we all know that there is an opportunity to create a more efficient system and to be able to use this as an opportunity to manage the OHP budget in a better way. So we've done some preliminary work. The health leaders in Oregon, the physician groups, hospitals, insurance companies actually got together, the Health Leadership Council, and commissioned a study from some actuarial experts, Milliman, who took Oregon health plan data and looked at how we stacked up to national benchmarks. And what they found was that we were quote-unquote moderately managed system, that there were systems that were performing better, and that if we were to become sort of the best in class in terms of how some systems are being managed around the country, that just looking at about half of the expenditures, I only looked at half, that could create an opportunity for about $120 to $140 million of savings. That's just on half of our Oregon health plan spend. That didn't include ideas such as integrating mental health and physical health. It didn't include some of the issues around developing robust primary care homes, some of the care coordination, use of new community health workers, and some of the things that we're looking at in the reform. So we're having them do this analysis. They'll be back in January with that. I think the issue isn't just simply one of dollars, it's also one of timing. And I think it's something we've discussed, that the ability to create some better efficiencies in our local healthcare delivery systems isn't going to happen overnight. So it's not going to happen if we have CCOs forming July 1, they're not going to, right out of the gate, be able to change how care is delivered, pay differently, et cetera. They're going to need some time, 6 months, a year, to be able to realize those savings. So part of what this is going to show is not just what the opportunity may be in broad terms, but also what the timing may be. And it's because of that, and it's something we've mentioned to many legislators, we're working very closely with the federal government to see whether or not, and we're optimistic that we can get some federal support over the next year to, in essence, help give us the time to get to that more efficient delivery system. For every dollar we spend in Medicaid at the state side, it's $1.50 of federal dollars. They have a huge stake in helping us create this better system. I'm going to turn things over to Mike for 1 minute, and we'll be ready for questions. Is that okay?
Yeah. You almost got to 20 minutes.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members, for the record, Mike Bonetto with the governor's office. I'm last for a specific reason, that is to be brief. Two things I wanted to highlight. One was a legislative concept that was sent to you a couple weeks ago, and then I also want to just talk quickly about legislative oversight. The ledge concept that you have in front of you is very succinct, and specifically, if you remember 3650, there's a specific section, section 13, that requires specific reports to come back to you for approval before implementation can begin. So basically, all we're saying is that the legislature would approve those reports and allow implementation to begin. So those reports pretty much are summarized in the business plan and then also with the medical liability. The second piece of the LC just had to do with some data sharing, information sharing between DCBS and OHA. It was seen more from a legal perspective as a technical fix, but that was in there. The last thing I would highlight was legislative oversight. I think during many conversations we've had with you, even conversations last week on the phone, it was brought up. So if we were to move forward past legislation, what is the appropriate legislative oversight on all this work? And I think that's it's a great comment. I think we're very interested in what is the appropriate mechanism. Is it the e-board? Is it the continuation of this group? So I think that's something that we would certainly welcome your feedback on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We had a couple of questions on the medical liability stuff. Let's take those, and then we can move into a round robin dealing with the questions on the implementation plan. It's Senator Bates and Senator Shields, please.
Okay, thank you. Our partners in the back east still on the line here with us?
Do we still have the consultants on the line?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. This is Senator Bates. I'm a senator out here. I'm also a practicing physician, so I'm very concerned primarily in this discussion about defensive medicine costs, not actually that concerned about premiums and payouts. They're less than 1% of the total cost of health care, but we're very concerned about defensive medicine. And it's very difficult to get to this very gray area of a physician doing everything he or she can for a patient versus doing more than they need to do, trying to cover themselves against medical malpractice or a tort situation. And that's very hard to get to. What you described with your surveys is a little concerning to me because it's so subjective again. And I'd be interested in hearing a little bit more about how you're comparing systems. As an example, here in Oregon, we have actually three different tort systems. We have one for the Veterans Administration, which is a federal system and under a very different tort situation. We have one for Oregon Health Sciences University physicians, which is somewhat different than the general physicians. And the patterns they use for ordering studies and imaging and treatment, it would be interesting to be able to see a direct comparison, because that is real, from my point of view, real statistical evidence, not just sort of subjective information. You did mention also something about comparing us to other countries, which have very different systems also. So I'd like to know how much of that's going to be in the report and what your thoughts are on what I've just laid out. I'm sort of the Mark Twain kind of guy. There's lies, there's damn lies, and there's statistics. So tell me what you can tell me about really comparing systems. Thank you.
Hi, this is Kate Baker. I'll just answer briefly for my part and let other people jump in as well. You lay out some really important challenges of trying to quantify the degree of defensive medicine, because how do you point to a particular test and say that one was because of the liability system, whereas that other one was really warranted even in the absence of concerns about being sued in the future? And that's one of the statistical challenges. And one of the methods that people use is to try to look across systems with different liability rules, just the way you described. Looking at patients in one system versus patients in another doesn't completely solve the problem, though, because you might think that the patients in the VA system versus on Medicare versus privately insured are different in lots of ways that drive different use of healthcare, not just the exposure of the physicians who are treating them to different liability systems. So we're going to be drawing on a wide literature that tries to take those differences into account, but just a straight comparison of the spending on diagnostic tests for patients in those different settings, for example, might yield misleading estimates of how much of the care is because of defensive medicine, because lots of other things are different as well. And that's exactly the kind of concern that we'll be trying to parse out, but that I don't have answers for you yet about.
Thank you.
Representative Shields? Senator Shields?
Thank you. I suppose this is for Dr. Wright or any of you, actually. I'm looking at a study that was recently done by Dr. Ben Paxton of the Duke University Medical Center that indicates that doctors who have a financial interest in imaging equipment may be ordering unnecessary scans. And I was wondering if in your surveys you will be asking that question. If somebody indicates that defensive medicine is going on, will you be asking them if they have a financial interest in imaging equipment?
This is Bill Wright here. That's not something that's currently part of our survey. I mean, we don't have any kind of questions that are targeted at trying to capture the financial interests that that any particular physician has.
Don't you? Do you think you should?
It's certainly something that seems like something that's worth investigating. It wasn't something that was part of our original design, though.
To follow up, this is Kate Baker. With limited survey space, we really wanted to drill down on the defensive medicine components that were the focus of our mandate. I think the other issues of the role of ownership, the role of competition versus monopoly in markets, all of those seem also important drivers of utilization, but we really were focusing on the specific mandate to look at defensive medicine per se. All of those things probably happen with and without defensive medicine.
Mr. Chair, if I can, yes. I guess two things. It would seem to me, in my humble opinion, that would be reasonable within the scope of the study, but if you all decide that it's not, I think at minimum what I'd like to see in the report is, I assume you'll be doing a literature review, and if you could include in that literature review what the literature currently says about that particular topic. And then additionally, I assume at some point there'll be a draft of this report, and I think rather than having the final copy, you know, laid on our desks, it would be I would appreciate having a chance to take a look at the draft copy before it's finalized to provide any comment that I might like to make.
Let's go, Bert. Okay, great. Thank you. Let's move on to questions about the report. You've all had a chance to read it, and you've had a chance to talk briefly to Bruce and to Mike about it in the past. So let's open it up. Yes, Representative Daugherty.
I think mine might be more of a comment or a suggestion as a question. Going over and talking about the global budgeting, I have concerns. I mean, we all want to realize savings in this, and the only concern that I have is down the road putting all medical plans, in other words, having OEB and PEB in with Medicare and Medicare reimbursements, and I'm concerned about that for two reasons. One, don't raid the risk pool. You know, make sure that you keep that because it's so very important. And then second of all, I'm just concerned that if indeed that's something that you're thinking about down the road, it's very hard to get, in this day and age, physicians to cover the Medicare reimbursements. And so I would just hope that PEB and OEB, you know, will kind of remain out of the system for now, if not forever. But those are my concerns. And then also not keeping the risk pool hands off.
Yeah, Chair Greenlick, Representative Daugherty, members of the committee. You know,
it'd be all right for this session just to answer the question.
Okay. you're assuming I was going to do that.
No, I wasn't, but you can't hide behind that.
we The work we've been doing around the global budget really pertains to the global budget as it for the Medicaid population. And we certainly understand that there will be many issues to take into consideration that are unique and different if and when the CCOs move forward to OEB, PEB, Medicare. So we're aware of that. Okay. And I think for this document, this is really about how we do this within Medicaid and get some experience with that so that we have the potential to move forward.
Thank you very much for clarifying.
President Dorney, the other thing I would add on is that I think from the very beginning, we've always talked about this as a choice for PEB and OEB. And I think, you know, we have to demonstrate better value. And I think that then it's going to be a consumer choice of whether or not they would want it to select a CCO as a as an option for them. But I think, we, as you mentioned, we still have a ways to go before we're there.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can only imagine the amount of work that's gone into to getting to this point or to the February session. And I'd like to express appreciation for all that that has gone on from the lay side as well as the executive side of the House. But Bruce, my question really focuses on the financial estimates, and as you know, that's been something that's, that I've had an interest in ever since this discussion began. And my question is, to what extent will the financial estimates be essentially a cost-benefit analysis? And how inclusive are the costs? And let me just give you an example of related costs. And I share this from the perspective.
Could you move close to that mic? I think.
Okay.
We're having a hard time hearing you.
Oh, excuse me. I'll try to speak up. And coming from the background of local healthcare in my district, we were faced with making a decision, an IT decision, looking at healthcare reform and the requirements to meet those IT metrics. We wound up making a decision to invest $98 million in Epic. $98 million. Now the feds have promised that they will support that to the tune of $20 million. But if it were not for the requirements of reform, those costs would not be incurred. Another issue that, and to my question of how global is the cost basis, does it include state and local and the CCO overheads? Looking at the metrics that we're going to be requiring of the CCOs, I can see overhead on overhead on overhead just to meet those reporting requirements for quality. And what additional costs will be incurred at the local level as well as the state level. So maybe, Bruce, if you could respond to that cost benefit and how inclusive is it of all of these costs?
I think some, but not all. But I think we can get at much of what you're talking about. The cost benefit of the individual system change, I think we'll work with our consultants to do the best in terms of, I think what you're getting at is, what is your net cost? If you create some system efficiencies, such as you hire community health workers to reduce emergency department utilization, you can't simply look at the savings you get from decreased emergency department utilization. You also have to include in that the cost of the intervention that you're doing to get some of those savings and really look at some of the net costs. And we'll work with the consultants to try and tease some of that out, understanding that they're really looking at this broadly about what may be some of the potential that's available, but we'll try and do our best. The cost of overhead has never really been anticipated as being a part of that analysis. Having said that, we will be looking at and providing some of the what we feel are the administrative costs to successfully operate a CCO. That'll be a part of a global budget as something different from, you know, the potential efficiency savings within the system. And I think we've been operating on, in a manner whereby we want to make this as administratively lean and not burdensome as possible. And we'll be working as hard as we can. And I think that's part of the tension we've had between the flexibility and the accountability. Don't want there to be a burdensome administrative structure to report the metrics. The group has been actually relying on looking at what data is available and choosing metrics so that they're chosen specifically around metrics where there's data that's easily available rather than a metric and then millions of dollars to have to go out and create the systems to get that data. So we're going to try and remain as administratively lean as possible, and that will certainly be a part of the budget but not a part of the cost savings piece.
Please.
One of the
Frank, can I just hold this one? Are there going to be any other questions on the medical liability issues? Not we can release our experts to go along their way. You're going to have. Okay. Well, good. You finish up.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Well, at the end of the day, the benefits have to exceed the costs.
Okay.
And my concern is that we are inclusive of all of those costs that are being developed throughout the systems. I would draw your attention to something that came to my attention last night, was a New England Journal of Medicine article that was just releasing a study that looked at medical homes, and I don't know whether you've seen that or not, but it's worth taking a look at because in response to the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003, what they did is they did a pilot project study of the medical home concept. It covered 242,000 patients. It had a control group. And at the end of the day, the study indicated that the savings were marginal and the cost of implementing it was $400 million. And that is a major tenet of our concept, is that medical home. And in fact, now we have a study that indicates that the savings were in fact not there. It did not decrease the ER visits and the hospitalizations. So I would suggest that you maybe factor that information into the financial model.
We will.
Let's not get confused with any information, please. Representative Doherty, you have a question? And then we'll
the question dealing with the tort reform of the malpractice, and this is something maybe they're looking in with the surveys, and I realize that people maybe are over-tested because there is that fear of a malpractice suit and so on. I guess what my question is part of the surveying and part of the end result going to take into consideration where there really is negligence? On the part of a physician or a hospital or a care center where there really is negligence and proven negligence. I would just hope that would also be a consideration when we're talking about the reforms of malpractice, because unfortunately there are cases where this occurs, and it's not necessarily being handed the wrong instrument, but physically the physician has maybe not been there. And we've had a very, very visual case of that coming out of Kaiser with the physician who ended up in New Zealand or Australia. And so I would just hope that would be also part of it, or I guess not part of the malpractice, the tort reform issues.
Would any of our experts on the phone like to comment on that?
This is Bill Wright. I am sorry, I had a really hard time hearing the question. It sounded like you were asking if we were trying to determine cases of negligence as part of the survey, but
I guess that's what it is. I think in the survey, I mean, the physicians aren't going to say it, but I would assume from there's some sort of data as to whether there has been proven negligence on the part of either a hospital or a physician, and I would just hope that that would be part of the deliberations and the conversation if you're talking about malpractice reform.
I think that makes a lot of sense. It's not something that we've tried to explicitly capture as part of the survey, but I think there might be some other ways to bring that idea in for sure.
Thank you.
Into the reporting.
Yes, sir. So, Conger, do you have a question?
I do. So, actually, I'm going to restate that maybe a different way. Is there any way to capture whether where other jurisdictions have implemented malpractice reform, if there's been any impact, especially a negative impact on quality of care? So that wasn't actually my question, but that occurred to me when Representative Doherty was asking her question. The other question I had, two, one is just a quick clarification. I never heard anyone say that we're talking about non-economic damages when we talk about caps, but I'm assuming that that's the case. We're only talking about non-economic damages.
That's right. We are just looking at non-economic damages at various levels. And in terms of whether we can look at quality of care as an outcome, I'd be happy to add that in. I will say that the literature is very limited and very imperfect. It's a very difficult question to study, but there are a few studies that tell us about the effects of different reforms on patient outcomes as a proxy for the quality of care.
I think that would be valuable information for us as we consider the whole picture that you're going to present. May I follow up with one other question?
I'll make a note to include that.
Thank you. The other question I had is related specifically to forming medical panels. Is there any way, or as an alternative, could we look at maybe having some kind of quantified best practices that would operate as evidence of non-negligence if they're followed?
So that's an excellent question. I believe you're referring to the idea of safe harbors for adherence to well-accepted clinical practice guidelines. It's an idea that's caught a lot of attention. It wasn't, however, among the proposals that we were asked to study as part of this work.
Was that Michelle?
It was.
Thank you.
This is Senator Bates again. I think Representative Conger and I are thinking of the same thing, or maybe I'm not, and I'll apologize if I do. There are panels in some states that look at cases. Some are binding, some are non-binding. Idaho has a panel system, Indiana does, and Maine do. And the results of those that we've seen so far are kind of mixed, whether they're binding or non-binding or whether they're effective. Idaho being close to us, we hear about that the most, and they claim their system has reduced the number of claims and actually resolved claims quicker, helping the patient, frankly, more than help and hurting the patient, but saved a lot of money because a lot of these cases never go to court. They get settled on a pre-panel basis, and that's a plus for the entire system from the point of view of patients and physicians are concerned. But is that going to be a part of your discussion, also looking at states that have these panels? And Representative Conger, is that what the kind of panels you're talking about?
We won't be doing case studies of particular states. We think that the most rigorous approach is to look at studies that have aggregated data from lots of different states, some of which have panels and some of which don't, and compare various outcomes across those different regulatory regimes to draw conclusions about the effects of the panels. I will tell you that what that literature says in a nutshell is that panels don't really help. In any study like that, what you're looking at is the average population-wide effect of such a reform, and there will be states that are outliers. There are states that do more poorly than average and better than average. The findings that we'll be focusing on won't really capture those unusual situations, but the most robust finding from the best studies is that medical panels, in fact, tend to increase the amount that people tend to spend prosecuting cases by adding an additional layer of administrative review before people get to trial. And we have to remember that it's ordinarily the case that 85 to 90% of cases settle before trial. So the marginal effect of inserting these panels when you're already looking at settlement rates that high is pretty small. And based on what I'm seeing in the Oregon data, it is really a tiny percentage of cases that ever go to trial, even in the absence of panels.
So if I can respond to Senator Bates, I think... I was thinking of having a set of best practices, and I think it was Michelle said that would operate as a safe harbor. So if a provider followed those best practices, that would be, on the face of it, that would be evidence that the provider was not negligent. And I think you could have those with or without the panels.
Okay, well, you guys are welcome to stay and listen in. But you're also welcome to leave if that suits your needs. You know, it's past lunchtime in the East.
It is. This is Michelle. Thank you very much. And should any of you have additional questions, please don't hesitate to contact me. I believe that OHPR can provide my contact information should you need it.
Thank you very much. Bruce, I have a question. One of the critical issues in 3650 was the issue of defining the criteria of what a CCO is. I notice in your implementation plan you punt on that one and suggest that will happen somewhere along the timeline. Is that not something you would plan on presenting to the legislature to deal with as a part of your, and if so or if not, have you begun to work on that absolutely critical question as to what's a CCO?
I think if you look at the proposal, it doesn't say here's the definition, but we begin to outline what the criteria are, that the certain governance criteria, the ability to deliver a particular amount of care, and the answer to your question will be defined not definitionally, but by a set of criteria that an organization will need to meet. And if you meet those criteria, that will be a CCO.
Well, let me quote you if that's okay.
Sure.
It says on page 9,
mm-hmm.
and it says, pending the direction and approval by the legislature during the February session, the board recommends that OHA promulgate administrative rules describing the CCO application process and criteria. Once the criteria have been finalized, the board recommends the following application process. So I thought I was reading from this that after we approve you to move ahead, you'll define, as a part of creating the application process, we'll define the criteria. Am I misreading that paragraph?
No, I think you are, Representative, but I would also direct you to Appendix A. I don't know if you spent much time on that, but I mean, that was, I think, a lot of the meat that was taken from the work group to start to put some meat on the bones in terms of the criteria. So I think that was to kind of give you an idea of when Bruce and OHA are going to be looking at the rules process, this is going to be, I think, a large component of it. And I think this is where you start to see a lot of the detail that is starting to get laid out for the CCO criteria.
I have looked at Appendix A, and I thought that was a sort of, here are the kind of things we could be looking at. Are you suggesting that this is your current draft of what the criteria are and that we ought to be prepared then to ask you questions about that specifically?
Yeah, yes. This is the initial framework, right?
Good. Okay. Great.
And again, it comes from...
Where is he? There he is. Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Chair Greenlake. Thank you guys for your presentation. It's always hear a little bit more. Like I've heard a lot, but I always hear a little more. I think to Representative Greenlake's question about defining what a CCO is, I think it's probably equally as important to define what it's not. I've heard a lot of folks talking about how possibly social service programs or education programs can all sort of be rolled into the CCO model, and I, to me, I think it would be very important for us to move forward with a very defined category, and you stated that earlier when you talked about funding for Medicaid. And I think that really defines our universe and what it is that we're going to ask a CCO to do and to take care of. And if there is opportunities in the future, or future legislatures see a need to broaden the coordination of services, I think that's fine. But in this particular case, I think we need to really focus on what this thing is going to become.
We agree.
Thank you.
Questions? From Conger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is actually just a suggestion. On page 10, talking about governance, I think this is, I'm not looking at the language from the bill, but I think it's probably consistent with the language in 3650. It says a majority of the board will be individuals with a financial interest in the CCO. I think it might be more accurate and better to say that entities or persons with a financial interest in the CCO will be able to appoint a majority of the board members. And there's a couple of reasons I say that. Individuals probably in most cases aren't going to have a financial interest. It'll be entities. And the entities will want to appoint some employee or officer. That just is a technicality. But the other thing that occurred to me is that it's possible that entities with an interest in the CCO may actually want to appoint someone other than an officer as their appointee to the board, and we should probably allow them the ability to do that.
It's good feedback. We appreciate it.
Senator Kennemer?
Yes.
I guess am I reading this as kind of a legislative concept? Is this the way the bill might read in this draft? Or are we talking more of criteria? How's this going to proceed?
The bill, the LC that was given to you, was very short.
Yeah.
So it's basically just allowing the approval of these reports. So this is the bulk. This is all the reports that we were asked to provide. But then you would just be approving it in a legislative concept. So we're not going to go rehash 3650. You guys have already done that at length. So now it's just the approval process.
But this would, in essence, be what you will hold me accountable for as the agency director for implementing. In other words, this is the blueprint, the guideline for how over the next several months following the February session we would implement this. And our hope would be this would give you as the legislature some detail and comfort in how we as the agency were going to approach this. For example, that appendix with the criteria, how we were thinking about listing those, how people would need to respond to those, and it would be the document by which you would be able to hold the agency accountable so that we didn't come back in 6 months and have this look very different from what you had thought.
I think you have a follow-up.
I guess it's kind of interesting to me, you know, as we're trying to change the system and look at outcome-based, there's an irony here, and I addressed this the other day when we were talking, that we, what seems to be occurring here is we do an analysis of what's working, and then we prescribe what, how to do it instead of what the outcome we want. And I just provide that as sort of feedback, because I think as I read through this, it gets very prescriptive. And I hearken back to my days as a county commissioner, and I'm thinking, oh my God, I'm going to have to hire four more bureaucrats to figure this stuff out, and we're going to be focused on dotting the I's and crossing the T's instead of being innovative and flexible and creating a system. And I guess, I'm sorry, but I just think, you know, and I'm wondering, where is the flexibility for creativity? It looks like what we've done is we've analyzed the best work we've got and said, apparently this is how they accomplished it, so this is the checkoff list you must meet. And I I think we're violating our own process, if I may put it that way.
Thank you. I mean, I appreciate that input. As the policy board has looked at this, what we've tried to do is structure some of this, or we've urged Bruce and the staff to structure this as essentially an attempt to figure out what are the outcomes that we're looking for. Yeah. And as we ask people who wish to become CCOs to go through an application process to essentially answer questions for us. How do you intend to do one or two or three of the things that we think are important? If we're not getting at that, then we need to go back and look at how we're structuring this. But the goal really has been to say, we are looking for outcomes. We are interested in your creative approaches as to how to get at the answers. And so we need to think that through and take that as input.
Lily?
Yeah. You know, one of the ironies is that the stakeholders, and if you know, have been really, you know, coming to us over and over again asking for more prescription.
Yeah.
And that's that balance between flexibility, I think, and accountability. And thank you for bringing up the issue of outcomes, because what we're really trying to say is, if you're going to take responsibility for this population of people that the state is right now, to represent Daugherty's, you know, point, you know, these are people right now that the state has responsibility for making sure that they stay healthy. And if you're going to do that, you have to demonstrate that these people are healthier at the end of the day than they were at our last kind of organizational structure. I also think one thing that is different about some of this is it is the coordination. I mean, as we think about what will happen to the patient, one of the big differences, it won't just be the client with a one-on-one relationship anymore with a single provider. It will be a community taking responsibility and the community having to contribute to that. So we won't be looking at the doctor, the hospital, the specialist, the, you know, fill in the blank as we go down the line, you know, but it will have to be, is this person's health benefiting from, are they achieving their maximum potential? Not just did this test result in, you know, some one procedure being better. So, you know, it's hard to get the language that allows for that innovation to say this is the best way to keep these people healthy. I'm responsible for these 100 people. You know, how am I going to keep them healthy? And then, like, well, you know, I'm worried about, have you thought of this? And I want this in the concept. So I don't know if that helps, but it's kind of like where we are. It's just hydraulic.
Wait, just one more. I'll try to...
I want to get to this one and this question as well.
And I appreciate that. I think it's a huge balancing act, and I don't know. You know, I guess there was just one more thing, as long as I'm kind of editorializing and making comments. It was interesting to me to read through this, and I started writing names in the margins. There are certain pet concepts that all of us have, and... I'm just not sure how much they need to play in there. I think, you know, good sense and professionalism account for an awful lot of things. You know, and I don't know that I need to have a note that the clinics need to be close to the patients. I think the system will work that out. And people who aren't culturally competent, I suspect, are incompetent. The other piece that's related to that is, I don't know, but maybe there ought to be a little bit of thought about how you get rid of these people or organizations that are dysfunctional,
mm-hmm.
Which is the most difficult, particularly in public, to do. You know, rules do not make incompetent or dishonest people competent or honest. And that, frankly, although we haven't addressed it usually bluntly, that is one of the fundamental issues that is here. People who are over-prescribing utilization of their equipment, for example, that's an issue, and it's very difficult to address.
Now, this is going to require culturally on the part of us as an agency something we take very seriously, which is changing our focus as government
yeah.
from regulatory to a government and an agency that helps to encourage and stimulate innovation. And that's what this is.
Not the usual.
It's not the usual. The same kind of change that we're asking for in the healthcare system is exactly the kind of change we need to have in terms of how we approach this. And this is the beginning of that. And we really see this as evolutionary. And I would agree with you that the first, I think the first knee-jerk reaction of a lot of us is, how do you put down all the specifications? Whether, in fairness, that be from the government side or from all those names that are in the margins, Representative Kenemer, that you have, they all want to see certain prescriptive ways of getting at their piece, but then being innovative about everything else. And I think we all have to think about how we're going to do this differently. And, you know, our sense is more and more as this document is a guideline and not a checkoff list. It's not going to be how you check off each thing, but it's going to be, show us the innovation that's going to allow you to achieve the sentiment that's in there.
Bruce, I want to push a little on what Lillian raised. I mean, I do want to talk about what I've characterized as the triple aim nonsense. And I continue to believe.
So. Appropriately so.
I mean, what you said is, we've got a CCO here that has 5,000 people that's taken care of, which is a minute. Now, at the end of a year, you're going to prove that those 5,000 people are healthier because of what happened in that CCO? I mean, there's nowhere in the history of health research has anything like that ever been done. Are we really banking on that? I mean, is that what we're going to really require the CCOs to determine that they've made their participants healthier? What the hell does healthy mean in this context?
I think that's what I am just naive enough, but also aspirational enough to think that if we think about this differently, we can do that. And I'll just give you some things of why I feel hopeful, you know, about this, Representative Greenlee.
Don't tell me why you feel hopeful.
No, I'm going to give you
examples. Give me an example of any place
I'm giving
that's been
you
done.
Examples of what has happened right over the last 3 to 5 years and some results we're seeing in the last 3 to 6 months in the patient population that we take care of. We're seeing, by changing our assumptions about how we provide care, we can identify people that have been rotate, and this is just the beginnings. This is why I say I'm hopeful. I don't have a New England Journal article to identify with, but we've, by being thoughtful and looking at not just one patient encounter after another, but okay, who's coming in? What are their issues? And aggregating some of the high users, and saying, okay, let's go out and talk to them and say, like, what is it? Why are you doing this? You know, why are you going in now the emergency room? You know, what's going on? Getting some feedback from them, and also finding out, okay, well, if these are the barriers, or if this is why you're cranky about some of your providers, let's us change how we're doing this. And we expected to see some results for some of this work targeting high utilizers, and we didn't assume that they were the problem. They were utilizing too much. We assumed that we were the problem. Somehow, the way they interfaced with the system was in such a way that they couldn't stay healthy. They had, you know, their congestive heart failure was getting out of control. Their diabetes was getting out of control. And these are people with multiple chronic diseases, so they have all those problems. And they go in and out of the emergency room. Sometimes they stay in. Sometimes they didn't. Sometimes my doctors and nurse practitioners were saying, wow, you know, I mean, I didn't realize that. I see them. I thought I was doing everything I needed for them. I'm not asking them what are their issues. That cohort that we just started this summer on, we expected to see results in 9 to 12 months. We're seeing amazing decreases in cost and increases in patient engagement and patient satisfaction. And when, you know, there are some people here who will, you know, who will not live very much longer. They may live for 12 months or 18 months. I'm not talking about, like, health. Everybody gets to be 100. I'm talking about real meeting real people where they are and helping them stay healthier. So that's why I'm hopeful.
What does healthier mean in that context? And these are people with congestive heart failure that are going to die, as you just pointed out. How are they going to be healthier? And they're going to be dead.
Their day-to-day, their experience of their life while they're alive has fewer interventions, more activities of daily living, more engagement, more social engagement, and they're able to do things like, I'll give you one example, you know, from basically being housebound in a wheelchair to a walker to being able to go out and walk their dog and go to their supermarket and go to the library. To me, that's healthier than being at home and 7 days a week and getting your medicine and calling the 911. So
I've got 5,000 patients of all kinds, and my payment is going to be determined by proving that those 5,000 people, on average, have ended up being healthier than they were before. That's what we're not talking about, the one patient you're helping.
Right.
We're talking about using patient health, the population health, as a measure the whole CCO is responsible for.
I think we can do it.
I think we're viewing this in Representative, I think you've hit on something that I think we're still working through, and in terms of what are we going to come out of the gate with in terms of baseline expectations, and then what are what we're calling even transformational expectations. You kind of see even some of this in Appendix A. And I think I would probably maybe agree to disagree. This triple aim is nonsense. I think it does set a bar in terms of vision. Can we get there out of the gate right now in terms of having every metric? No. But I think what we want to do, and I think to Senator Morse's point, we cannot layer on additional administrative overhead for new sets of metrics. So what can we kind of take right here, right now, where we know we have tangible data that we can then, you know, have the CCOs show us, and then over time, can we begin to gather some of this on the transformational expectations? I think that's where we're going. I don't think we're looking at coming out of the gate with a whole new set of metrics that are untested. Bruce, do you?
No, I'd agree. I think Dr. Greenlich, I'd agree with you that our ability to measure overall health of the population after year one is not going to be possible. It is going to be possible to measure health over a long period of time. And in the beginning, I think it's going to be possible to set out a group of achievable metrics that hopefully will lead to health. And I think that's exactly
that's
what we want to do. It's very clear that certain, and we could go down them in a variety of places, the ability of people with mental illness to get timely mental health care and, appropriate mental health care actually keeps them out of the hospital, more functional in the community, hence, quote unquote, healthier. There are a variety of, I think, metrics that we can put out that will be what we want to achieve over the next 2 to 3 to 4 years. And then eventually, in 5 to 7 to 10 years, is when you do start to see changes in the health of a population. But we're not going to get there overnight.
It's going to be an entirely new population 10 years from now. It's not going to be the same people.
Correct. And I don't know that any of us have determined the single best metric that, you know, there's no blood test for health. There isn't, the single questionnaire to do that. But I think what we're looking to do is we've got to measure the system based on something. And right now, what we're measuring the system by is how much healthcare people consume. And we've got to move away from how much you consume. My goal isn't to be admitted to the hospital more.
Unless you need it.
Unless I need it. But even when I need it, it's going to be only as much as I need. My dad recently needed to be in the hospital, but didn't need to be in the hospital twice. and he ended up in the hospital twice. So my goal was to be certain he only got there once and got home, and that's what health is for him. So I think that's exactly where we've got to make that shift. And it's going to take time. And I think it gets at sort of all of this.
Let's move on. Senator Winters.
Thank you. Thank you.
After that, we have Cruz and Shields and Thompson.
Quick question. Looking at the timeline and with the implementation of July and looking at waivers, can I assume that the waiver application process has already been submitted to the feds? And if so, what has been submitted and what is their actual response to the waivers?
Senator Winters, we can't officially submit a waiver until we have the enabling legislation. Having said that, we're meeting regularly, every week, with a team from CMS. We have an Oregon team and a CMS team. We meet weekly. We've been exchanging drafts of papers around what the global budget will look like, what the criteria will look like, etc., and having increasingly more detailed discussions. It's our anticipation, and those discussions are looking at, you know, back and forth. Here are the things that the feds are telling us could potentially be showstoppers, and we're responding to them appropriately. Our goal is that coming out of February, we will be able to give the feds a waiver request that isn't a surprise, that they're familiar with, where they've seen most pieces of it, and where it's likely that we'll get a very quick turnaround because all of their questions will have been answered over the time being now. So we're moving forward, and it's our hope that we can get approval in late March, April. Very aggressive.
Follow up, because my concern is that we're not surprised.
Right.
And knowing that somehow the dialogue between the agency and CMS, that sometimes down the line that we can become surprised because they will require something of you that we may have not had privilege to or had information for. And I guess that is my concern of this dialogue that you're having back and forth, that this body is in the loop enough that when we make the decision, that we're making a very informed decision so that we're not, quote, surprised, quote, unquote.
Correct. My job, as I take it, is to be certain that I give CMS all the information and push them to be certain that come some point they don't say, well, wait a minute, you now can't do this or here's some new requirement. And we're pushing them hard to be able to do that. I can't guarantee that there won't be a federal surprise, but I certainly take my job very seriously in being certain that we have that dialogue and that we will minimize that at all costs. I do know the feeling when, I don't like it any more than you do, when I get surprised and then I have to talk to you about that very same surprise.
Well, I just think this is a huge transformation that we're talking about. We're talking about some tremendous sea changes, and and it's a lot of this is that I'm hearing is talking about good faith, and I want to make certain that that federal counterpart is also of good faith before we take some interesting steps forward. Including when you say flexible, how flexible is flexible even with them? Mm-hmm. As well as when you look around the state, we're talking about there's a distinct difference in resource availability if I'm talking metropolitan Portland and the Valley, and I'm talking over in the rural communities. So what kind of requirements, flexibility, are we truly going to have with CMS?
Senator Montes Anderson, if you want to get in at any time, let us know.
I'm fine.
Thank you.
Senator, two quick points. One, I just want to let you know, I mean, this is high, obviously, on the priority list for the governor, and he's already made a trip to D.C. in October, and to lay all of this out and really hopefully, get things Greece. He's going to go back again within the next few months to have the same dialogue. What I would recommend that we do at the January hearing is to lay out even the waiver elements that we're looking at. And I think even at that time, we'll probably give you a better indication of kind of CMS yeah. receptivity at that point.
Maybe we could invite them to join us in that discussion in January. It might be possible if one of the representatives from the feds could talk to us.
We can certainly see if they will.
And ask if they would. Senator Cruz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things, if I may. First, a personal frustration with the continual use of Madison Avenue terms, triple aim, and global budget, because we're talking about Medicaid. So let's call it Medicaid. And quite honestly, the perception of the public is we're transforming the healthcare system. We're talking global budget. It's a hell of a lot bigger than Medicaid. So I'd prefer we call it Medicaid. I'll give you a little history lesson. In 1973, the Legislative Assembly passed Senate Bill 100. Okay, Senate Bill 100 was a dramatic change in the way the state of Oregon did land use. Okay, the concept was that each county would develop its own land use system. The state would look at it and say, that's good. And then the counties would be allowed to go about their business in the way land use happened and the way it was developed. Reality is that the state involvement is so oppressive that nobody can do a damn thing in the state with land. Okay? Now, that for me is a concern on the front end of this thing, especially when we're talking about accountability. A couple things that are in the document that trouble me is, for example, that the CCO will partner with the counties for the mental health and public health, actually, to a large degree. And I would suggest that a CCO should not be partnering with the county. The county should be part of the CCO. I mean, that's for me. And getting back to Representative Greenlick's point of the measurables, I would suggest that when we are towards the end of this journey and we truly have this system that's all-inclusive, this is the healthcare system for wherever, this is a CCO, it will be a fully capitated system. It will be incumbent upon the providers in that system to be as efficient as they possibly can, to get the best outcomes they can, because it's their bottom line that's being served. Okay? And so I would just be really careful about all of these things we have to hit along the way, when the system should inform itself and the system should be the vehicle for the outcome. I'm looking forward to seeing some actual LC language on some of this stuff, because I appreciate the work that's been done here, but in my world, until I see LC draft language, it's not real yet. So
you have the draft.
Oh, I have the request. We don't have the LC.
And I know you don't have it yet, Mike, but I know it's in process.
But I do need to ask a follow-up, though.
Sure.
When you talk about more specifics of the LC language, I mean, what you have from us is what we're looking at moving forward in terms of allowing the implementation for the CCO.
You've got copies here in case you didn't.
So if you are thinking, I mean, of the specifics of metrics and everything else, that would be later, and that really would be in the rules process through OHA. But at this time, we were not necessarily thinking that was going to be okay. In legislative language.
Well, we may have a slight difference here. In 3650, basically, we said bring us something. If we like it, we'll say go forward. We didn't say bring us a concept and we'll bless it and then you create it. So So there's going to, you know, there's going to maybe need to be on the front end a little more specificity for some of us to be comfortable with moving forward.
Yeah, and we would be very, we're here today to get that feedback, and in terms of the, you know, the proposal, which I think does start to outline some of those specifics, whether, you know, today or at another time, the kinds of things that need to be added or that need to be deleted from this, that's what we're here to do. This is a work in progress.
And if I could just follow up, and I fully understand that, Bruce. We've had many conversations, but by the same token, I see this whole process that we're involved in as a very phased process, a very deliberate process. February is tomorrow. January of 13 is the next day. So, In legislative terms, the timelines are incredibly short here, and I my hope is that we do some stuff in February, but next legislative session, once we actually have time to get into real debates in the public forum, is where we kind of put more meat on the bones.
Well, and Senator Cruz, I think that's how we're approaching that. This, mm-hmm. If you look at the that Appendix A, the metrics, the matrix of suggested criteria, what we've really thought about, both the board and the agency, is that this really is something evolutionary. Much as we were talking about being able to measure health right off the bat, or what this will look like, that what we start with July 1, 2012, may look and should, quite frankly, look very different 3-4 years down the road. We're not going to get this absolutely right out of the box, and we have to look at this as an evolutionary process that we're all going to work together to refine. The basis is create these organizations, have them have the accountability and the budget and the sideboards that we begin to feel comfortable for around what they're accountable to deliver, and the ability to innovate. I mean, that's really the crux of this. And how do we move that forward?
And just one more, Representative, and thank you for allowing me to vent. But I would suggest at the end of the day, the accountability isn't to you, it's to the community. And that's a totally different dynamic than we've ever attempted before. It gets into measurables, but as long as there are measurables to OHA, that becomes tough. If we allow the communities to determine their own measurables, I think we're on the right track. So,
Senator Shields?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate what Senator Cruz is saying, because accountability to the community, having this under some kind of democratic control, I think will be very important. I wanted to get to your point and just provide my experience working closely in my wife's primary care practice, is that you asked what kind of metrics could be out there, and I think what you're getting at is there aren't really ways to measure health, but there are ways to measure things that are associated with better health. And out of all of the PPOs, MCOs, insurance companies that I've dealt with, the only one that I've seen that seems to work pretty well in primary care is Providence's system of tracking things like things associated with cost savings, like generic utilization, and then they also track how well a patient adheres to the regimen that's prescribed by the primary care provider. And then they provide additional conversion factor bump if you are better than the majority of your colleagues. And so I just want to make sure you were aware that there are some models locally that are out there. That one seemed to be reasonable in my dealings with them.
Sure. I mean, avoiding emergency room use, it seems to me, is an important measure. Does it make somebody healthier? Who knows? I mean, I might find it handy to go to the emergency room, and you might not want me to because it costs too much. President Thompson?
A couple of comments. We put a lot of emphasis on the CCO in
who has a financial stake or risk factors and whatnot. I would suggest that we be very careful on that pathway, as I'm not hearing complaints or concerns about people trying to get out of CCOs. What I'm hearing is from people who feel left out of CCOs. They want a chair at the table, they have something to contribute, but they don't necessarily aren't necessarily in a position to take a big chunk of financial risk. So it has to be more about community-centered health care than just financial risk. Secondly, along those lines, and you alluded to double hospitalization a minute ago, I think we have to also be cognizant when we look at the chronic disease population, the 20% that's eating up 80% of our revenue, that this isn't just about hospitalization. We may find ourselves with models that are going to increase the amount of primary care disease state management intervention for these people in order to prevent expensive hospitalization and long-lasting negative effects down the road. So this isn't just about cutting back. I think we need to be prepared to take a lot of these people and push them into additional early-stage health care to prevent what's coming down the road. And I'm not sure that we're prepared to do that in the conversations that we're having about, particularly in the area of who are the providers and how many do we have for the population we're talking about. Somebody who can't get primary care is going to be a hospital disaster at some point.
You know, we'd agree. And I guess to get to your comment of the involvement of people at the community to get to the table, I think that we've been certainly operating under what I think was also the wisdom of the legislature, that it isn't, you know, the governance can't simply just be those who have financial risk. It has to be also reflective of the major components of the healthcare system. Now, obviously, it can't be 68 components, but hopefully what CCOs are going to do as they come forward is show how they really do involve the major components of the healthcare delivery system and how, in essence, they have a voice for and they incorporate and they work with those providers in the community. I think that's what the legislation says, and I think that's how we're going to be approaching this.
I think, though, in my experience, I'm hearing a little bit too much about who is perceived to have the financial control of the system instead of who is perceived to have the control of better health care in the system. And I honestly believe if we can go for better health care, we'll get the financial savings. If we go for control of the money, God knows what we're going to get other than control of the money. You know, we need to get the emphasis on the right syllable.
Senator Bates?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two operational questions or comments, if I could, from you, and then a bigger question following. This morning's been very helpful, I believe, and I think that hopefully at least a lot of questions have been answered, information shared with this panel. I'm very concerned as we go forward on two levels about feedback to the legislature on transformation. On one level, just getting information back and forth is a challenge. This is really a lot of changes with a lot of detail in it and a lot of differences in different parts of the state. And getting all information back to the legislature as a whole is going to be difficult. And I would suggest this joint committee is one of the best ways to do that. I'd like to see this continued, and I'll push our leadership to support that. The other side of it is not just getting information back and forth, but some kind of careful monitoring here. I think in February, the changes that you're hoping for in the Legislative Assembly as far as actual law and what others may or may not be wanting is going to be, to a great degree, determined by what kind of monitoring occurs after we leave in February. I kind of have a feeling that it's not likely that you'll be given a blank check or a green light and we'll see you in January. I think it'll be something in between there. And I would suggest that reporting back to this group and reporting back to the E-Board is probably the best approach to take here. Might even have an SPA of some type for some parts of this so that the legislature feels some confidence that things are going in the right direction and have an ability to really monitor that in a meaningful way. So that's two suggestions. And I'll talk to leadership about it.
We couldn't agree more. Okay. We view this, if we're going to be, and I really do mean the we, if we're going to be successful as a state in moving this forward, it's going to be that both the executive branch and the agency and the legislature work closely, communicate that there's the appropriate oversight, and we are totally open to the I don't want to preclude how best to do that. That's you tell us, and we will certainly comply with that.
You have a question?
Just real quick. The other issue is some of us, Representative Freeman, myself, and others have had an opportunity to travel around the state talking to various groups about this. The variation is striking, very striking, as you would expect. How fast the people are moving forward is also significant. But I'm concerned that if we're really going to get there for a lot of organizations or a lot of parts of the state by next January and hopefully by July, that we may need to look at, and I've mentioned this to you before, two ways of getting there. I call it a fast track. The criteria you have to reach should be the same for everybody. But those organizations that have already shown an ability to handle risk and manage large populations, we should be able to fast-track them into this because they have a proven record and the ability to do this. They'll have to partner up and change a lot. They'll have to partner with their counties and their mental health organizations and others. But MCOs and others can do this if we give them an opportunity to do that much more quickly than anybody else can. And frankly, at less risk to the state because we know they can do this. So the consideration for that, I think, is something important. And there might be two tracks, one for a brand new organization, a little slower, just fast track for organizations that have shown they can do it. And the last thing I'd like to comment on is a little tougher. You mentioned two or three times to me about the McMillan report saying that we are a moderately managed state as far as healthcare is concerned in Medicaid. My first reaction to that was kind of negative, and then I got to thinking about it. And we have parts of the state and organizations that really do a great job, I believe, in managing. And other parts and other organizations that in Medicaid that basically are just working as insurers with nothing in between. I would like to hear from you what McMillan's really saying about states that are apparently doing better management than they are. Now, the caveat is, when I've looked at other states and asked the questions at the ground level what's going on, they're not really managing. They're just paying less and cost-shifting it to the rest of the system. And I don't consider that managing it. They may have a lower per member per month payment and cost, but the overall cost of the system is worse. And so with that caveat there, is there really things we can learn that our CCOs can use from other states that certain organizations in our state are doing and certain ones aren't? And that's a tougher question. But I'd like to hear a little more about that, if you could share that with us.
Couple comments, and we'll share the report with you. What you'll see is not only is there variation from state to state, but what the report shows is that there's variation within our state, and a lot of variation. And some of the report is not just about the sorts of dollar savings, managing the dollars, but it is about reaching some of the outcomes of care. So it's indeed both, What the report doesn't tell us, though, and I think it's what you're really getting at, is, okay, those that are, you know, those benchmarks that are best, what did they do to get there? And what is the change in the delivery system, or the change that got them there? That we don't know, and we don't have. And I think it's a good thing to get to. I think what the report really just shows is some of the possibilities. And what we hope to have here in this state is understanding, apropos of your previous comment, that different parts of the state look differently. We think different parts of the state are going to get some of those outcomes in different ways. Bruce, and actually, we encourage that.
If you could share that with us. We are going to close at 11, and Representative Freeman has a question, and I have a question. Yeah.
Did you get it to me already?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, please distribute that to us.
Do you want to get to summarize what we heard?
I do need to put on the table this question. In your section where you talk about the global budget, the fifth point you have is the question of having state actuaries determine what the actuarial appropriateness of the global budget is. I don't understand what that means. It seems to me we have money and we have a certain amount to pass out, and the global budget puts all that money together and shares it in a risk-adjusted way, but what's actuarial about that? And what is it the actuaries will be doing to determine an actuarially sound budget?
We've been struggling with that, and this is actually one of the areas, apropos of Senator Winters, that we're working very closely with the feds on. I think what it does is it creates a bit of a different way of using actuaries, where we can, rather than simply having actuaries look at medical trend, it actually relies on actuaries to look at the spending plans in a community and a budget, and being certain that if you do certain things, there will still be adequate funding to meet certain needs.
That's not an actuarial question.
Well, I think what the actuaries help us do is...
That's an accounting question.
In my insurance experience, there's a couple of ways of looking at this. One is you can develop a product and ask the actuary to tell you what the price should be. The other is you can tell the actuary what you believe the market will pay and develop a product that will match that ability to pay. We don't have ability to pay here in the patient sense. We do have it very much at the state sense, and we need to make sure that what we're putting together matches the ability to pay. And so it's a matter of just turning around the
actuarial science deals with risk, right?
Yep.
And this isn't about risk. This is about a known population, and you're going to determine how they deal with it. I mean, we don't have time to get into this, but I did really want to put it on the table, and it would be very useful if you keep feeding us back information. I think we're all really concerned about how you create the budget for, I mean, I think the definition of what a CCO is and how they get a budget is probably two of the most, and the outcome measures. Those are
and
the three.
Part of this is also the assumptions by which you're paying by.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's actually a way we work with the actuaries in putting together the 11% budget reductions most recently. The assumptions about what payment would be were adjusted, and plans came forward and said, we believe we can get access by paying X, and if we pay X, then the actuaries were able to look at those rates and be able to say that they were actuarially sound given the payment assumptions which were provided. So it quite frankly, you're correct, the money is the money. Part of this is being able to fit into a federal construct which talks about actuarial soundness. And the third piece is, you know, in the end, I do think we have to be realistic about expectations. And I think having actuarial involvement in the numbers helps us be certain about whether or not we can meet certain aspirational goals in all of this, given the dollars we've got.
Well, guys, I do want to thank you very much. I think you've done some extraordinary work, both the board and the staff. I think it's been very useful to have this session. You'll hear a lot of feedback this afternoon that I urge you to listen very carefully to. And I'm glad we had the opportunity to deal with it. And thank you all. We'll close this panel. Let's take a 5-minute stretch, and we'll move immediately to some other interesting discussions about the health insurance exchange and its proposals. We stand at ease. session. Chip, do you want to call the committee back in session?
I call the Senate Health Care Committee back into session.
And thank you guys very much. Appreciate the work you've done up till now, and you got the floor.
Okay, Co-Chair Greenlick and Thompson and sitting in Chair Senator Shields.
And Modest Anderson on the phone.
Oh, Senator Modest Anderson, hi there.
Backbencher Shields.
My name, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange. And with me is Amy Faber, and she is the Deputy Director. And Chair Greenlick.
Put the microphone more closely in front of him.
He heard you personally.
He's never done this before. Let's see if we
can. Can you hear me now, Senator?
Is that better, Senator? Can you hear?
There may or may not.
I don't wonder if this is working.
No, it should be.
Hello?
Responsibility. I don't think there would be.
Go. Okay. We have about, I believe, about 45 minutes to go through this in a brief way, and I'm going to start it off by turning it to Amy and let her kind of go through a process with you.
Great. Good morning. For the record, I'm Amy Faver, Deputy Director of the Exchange, and let me remember to move these slides as we go. Just a brief overview of how we've gotten here and where we're going. The draft of the business plan that we sent to you, I think Sandy sent to you yesterday afternoon, was reviewed by the Exchange Board of Directors at their board meeting last Friday. And over the weekend, we incorporated some comments and feedback and things that they wanted to see changed. That's the version before you now. For members of the audience out there, we don't have copies of the entire business plan here today, but that can be downloaded through our website, which is www.orhics.org. So, and the full version that we're going to be discussing today is on our website right now. We know we don't have a lot of time with you all today, and that you just got this yesterday. Probably many of you haven't had much chance to dive into it. So over the next couple of weeks, and you know, we know it's the holidays, so we might be calling you for feedback. We're going to check in individually with each member of the House and Senate Healthcare Committees to find out what questions you have about the business plan, if it covers the things that you would expect it to cover, and any input or feedback that you have for us that we can then bring to our board. They are meeting again on January 11th. We'll be bringing them a revised version of this business plan based on the feedback we get from you all, and they'll consider their continue their review process. We expect that we'll be bringing to you a revised version of this business plan at your interim committee meeting on January 18th. It says 19th on the slide, but Sandy corrected me before. It was after I'd already sent it. So we'll get that to you on the 18th, and then any further revisions that need to happen, we'll make a final version of the plan to be considered by the full legislature in February.
So I think it's important to say that there are several opportunities for you individually and as committees, as well as for our stakeholders and for the board to still have input over this next really month and 2 weeks as we prepare really the final report for you. One piece that you haven't gotten is a lot of the detail in the appendix that should be will be completed by the 20th. By the presentation on the 18th. But when we met with you individually and started talking about what you wanted with the business plan, you said there were basically four general questions that you wanted answered. First of all, what is an exchange? Secondly, what the value is to Oregonians? Third, how much it's going to cost? And then more importantly than in some respects was, is it going to be sustainable? Because there's no state general fund dollars that have ever been talked about for the exchange. It is strictly the federal grant dollars and then self-supporting in 2015. And you wanted some of the modeling that we could do to show that, in fact, it would be sustainable in 2015. And that's kind of the focus that we've given for this particular document. It's also important to note as you well know, a variety of decisions have not been made on the federal level in terms of the regulations, and until some of those decisions take place, it is difficult for us to make final decisions around marketing and outreach, the role of navigators, agents, qualified health plans, essential benefits. So we still have a lot of things that are
That the feds have given up the definition of the essential benefit package to the states?
Yeah, Representative Greenlick, Friday they basically threw the grenade over the fence to the states. It was punting the decisions around which option, well, there are four different options they've been looking at to choose to determine the essential benefits. And they've passed that to the states. And that's, to us, is great news. I think that, like the exchange, gives the state of Oregon really the ability to look at what its citizens want and need and to frame that in our marketplace rather than let somebody in Washington, D.C. do that. The bad news is that's going to be a difficult task. We're going to have to pull a lot of folks together, the governor's office, DCBS, OHA, carriers, stakeholders, to really making sure that we can provide a good analysis and examination of those options for whoever is going to make the decision, and I don't know who that is. So good news, bad news, but I err on it's good news.
So, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Just to follow up on your comment, so can you proceed and have things ready for the February session when they've now declined to do the essential benefit package?
Well, Mr. Co-Chair and Co-Vice Chair, Representative Kennemer, I don't think so. I don't think we want to hurry into that kind of discussion. I mean, you are talking about decisions that are going to ultimately impact anywhere from 700,000 to a million Oregonians enrolled in individual and small group markets. In 216, as you know, the small group market expands to 100. To take a very 2 or 3 week kind of analysis of that, I think, would not be prudent. I think it needs some dialogue with the healthcare committees as well as the state agencies that are going to be doing some of that. So, and the second piece is that we also have to wait for the feds. They have not punted to us some of the decisions around cost sharing for the essential benefits. So we still are waiting for some things from them. Amy?
Just to follow on, it's important.
I didn't mean to interrupt your flow. Please move on.
Okay. I just want to say it's important to remember, too, that for the essential benefits, that will impact all insurance plans in the commercial market, not those. It's not specific to the exchange. So it's really a broader conversation than just the exchange.
Yes. Okay, so moving on, we're on slide 4, I believe, which is really the mission, which is to improve the health of all Oregonians by providing health coverage options, increasing access to information, and fostering quality and value in the healthcare system. This kind of gets back to our role as more just than enrolling people in coverage. It, hopefully that will lead to better health and also becoming that trusted site or trusted place that people can go to for some information. We're in the business plan, the back pages are the financials. So I'm going to start, though, on those back pages and just kind of go through some of the concepts. The other part we've had a lot of discussion about, and we'll go through that, too, but I think it's important that you know what we've done on some of the enrollment projections and financial projections. First of all, around the enrollment, and I'm on slide 5, the enrollment projections are based really on national economic models developed by Jonathan Gruber. He is an economist at MIT, very well known nationally for the models he uses for predicting kind of enrollments and around whether it's public programs like Medicaid or private programs like the commercial market. But they were adjusted by Wakely to really, a consulting firm, to really reflect kind of or Oregon's specific market using the 2009 reports that were published by the insurance division. I think it's important to note that these are estimates only, preliminary. They'll be revised as more information comes to us. The example of that is we expect that over the next 2 or 3 months, the 2010 data will be available from the Oregon Health Authority and the Insurance Division relative to what our market looks like in Oregon in 2010. We'll make the adjustments as necessary. The other thing I think it's really important is that these estimates do not really take into account how much outreach and communication or marketing that may be needed or we may be doing in 2013 and 2014 to get those enrollments. Obviously, if you don't spend anything on marketing, you're not going to have the enrollments than if you spend a lot on. The way I kind of summarize this is we're not quite sure what the product is, we're not quite sure what the price is, and we're not quite sure how much marketing we're going to do, so please consider these to be estimates.
Okay. So what's the problem?
Enrollment and financial summary. Wakely, and using Jonathan Gruber's models, basically provided three estimates, a low, moderate, and high. Now, a lot of times when you're trying to sell something, you come in and you just want to talk about the high. We decided that all of our financial estimates should be based on the moderate estimates of enrollment. I think that's key. So we're taking kind of the middle road on this. So that we use those moderate enrollment projections for both 2014 and 15, and that resulted in about 280 to 300,000 lives at the end of 2015. Using those moderate enrollment projections, we came up with an administrative fee that was about 2.5% for 2014 and 2.7% in 2015. And I want to remind you that our fee maximum set in statute in Senate Bill 99 was 5%. So both these figures are below that was established in statute. And I should point out that 2.5% for 2014 really is nothing more than a fee to build a capital reserve, an operating reserve that you can utilize in 2015. And we'll talk about that. The other thing, and I think Senator Morris mentioned this a number of times during the hearings during Senate Bill 99, was what's your break-even point? There's no state general fund dollars in this program in 11, 12, 13, or 14. It's all federal dollars. In 15, it's basically financed through the administrative fee. But what's your break-even? At what point do you kind of throw up your hand and say, we're in trouble? Our preliminary, and they are preliminary, estimates are that we will need at the end of 2015 between 100 and 120,000 enrollments in order to break even. Anything below that, and we're either eating into a capital account that we have, or we're losing money. So that's about a third of what our moderate projection is in terms of enrollment. It's about a half of what our low projection enrollment, and about a quarter of what our high projection enrollment is. So we feel pretty comfortable that given the models we've established that we're going to be able to be self-sufficient by 2015. All of the assumptions in developing this are contained in page 27 of the business plan, and if you want to at some point go through those and mark your questions when we contact you over the next couple weeks, we'd be happy to answer those. Slide 8 really just shows you the three levels for 14 and 15 between low, moderate, and high estimates, and the breakdown between individual coverage and small group coverage. Page 25 of the business plan, slide 9, is really our design budget. And I say that, design and implementation. Remember, we're looking at January 1 implementing. So the 2011, 2012, 2013 budgets are really the building phase, the planning and building phase. We really started our first grant September 1. Previous grants were with the Oregon Health Authority. So that's why that 2011 is a very small amount. And our first grant runs September through August, so you'll see in 2012 is the primary expenditure of that Level 1 grant. We anticipate in March or April of this year, we have, I think, until June, to go for what's called a Level 2 grant, which really covers the last 3 or 4 months of 2012 and all of 2013, and also our first year of operation in 2014. So all federal funds. There is no increase in assets. We're not saving any money at that point. We're not banking any capital funds. That really doesn't occur until 2014. Slide 10 shows you our first 2 years of operation. Shows you the moderate enrollment figures, 200,000 in 2014, 280 in 2015. In order to really figure out what kind of revenue you're going to receive off of that from an administrative fee basis, you have to do what's called member months. So the member months really drives a lot of the projections both for expenditures and revenues rather than the total enrollment. We're talking about a program that at the end of 2015 is going to have about $1.2 billion of premium go through the exchange or go to the carriers on behalf of those enrollees that we have. Shows you the administrative cost of 2.52% for 2014 and 2.73% for 2015. The administrative fee per member in 14 is about $10, and that is set totally unrelated to costs in 2014. But if you remember in Senate Bill 99, you said establish a capital reserve of 6 months of operating expense. So in 2014, we basically are using the administrative fee to establish a 6 month operating account for 2015. That's why your cost, which is the next line down, $16.72, is actually higher. That's covered by the federal government. The fee covers the $10.03. Now, I know that's kind of confusing, but it really has to do with building the cash flow and the capital account.
Yes, I'm sorry.
So if the capital account is built on saving some dollars from, you know, or charging this fee, what happens if you don't have enough members to build that capital account for 2015? I mean, is there a piece in this financial plan that will outline for us how then you fill that? Because when you said it earlier in your testimony, we would dip into our capital account, and I turned to Representative Kinnemer and said, well, where's that money coming from? How do you fill that bucket if people aren't diving into this and using
it? Mr. Chair, Representative Parrish, that's a good question. First of all, a couple pieces. We've established that at a six-month capital reserve account, you may only need a 60-day or a 90-day. We set it at the maximum so we could see kind of worst-case scenario, you know, how much money would have to be raised. It's all tied in terms of the enrollment, back to the enrollment. If we're below 100,000 at the end of year two, the capital account is the least of our concerns. There won't be a capital account. We will have exhausted it. So you should know primarily by, you know, the mid-2014 what you're going to really need for that capital account going into 15, because you'll have a good idea of what your enrollment is. The less enrollment, the higher the capital needs. The more enrollment, the less the capital needs, because you have a base of money that's coming in. It might be good if I can get some time with you and just go through that projection with you and show you that. I'm not the CFO, so I'm trying to kind of explain it, but we have taken that into account.
Can I follow up?
Sure.
If for some odd reason you don't hit those benchmark numbers of minimum enrollment, there's another committee I sit on, and I'm not going to name names, but they did a forward-facing, you know, portal for their base of consumer, you know, people in the state who would use that portal, and they spent a lot of money, and it's not being used. And so by all accounts, and you know, it was not a success. They're still kind of dumping money into it to try to keep it going. At what is there a shutoff valve mechanism in here if this is not being leveraged the way you think it's going to be leveraged at some point? Or
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Parrish, the shutoff valve is that every quarter we'll be reporting to you for the next foreseeable future how we're doing in terms of enrollments. The shutoff valve will eventually come from your and our board's overview of these financials on a quarterly basis as to whether we can be, you know, whether we've met our projections or not. And I shouldn't say meet our projections, because I want to get 500,000 people in here. What I'm doing, though, is trying to be conservative and say, but I'm going to base all of my assumptions from a financial standpoint on a very moderate level of enrollment. And I'm also going to say that I can make it financially on a low level of enrollment. So we will be reviewing those to you, you know, with you quarterly, that's required by statute, as we move towards and actually implement this program. So the shutoff is at some point the board, who has fiduciary responsibility for the financial well-being of that corporation, raising their hand to you and saying it's time to have some serious discussion about how we phase down rather than up.
You.
But you're saying you can make it on half of the low estimate of enrollment, is that right?
Mr. Chair, our preliminary estimate is that is correct. That is correct.
Go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Kenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go for it.
And I guess, you know, with 38 states challenging the ability of the federal government to coerce people into buying this, that has an impact too, if depending on what the Supreme Court decides.
Yes. Ms. Chair, Representative Kenner, it sure does. Because if they, for example, decide not to do the mandate, that will have some impact. I think that the governor and the legislature and OHA and all the parties are going to sit down and say, based on their decisions, what do we want to do next? I will tell you two things. One is that the history of this legislature is they've been interested in providing an exchange for Oregon citizens for a long time. Three sessions where we actually have this. I will say the key question is not going to be the mandate. It's going to be the funding. If they were in any way to withdraw funding for the development and operation of the exchange, I think it's a different ballgame.
No, it's the subsidies that I'm going to make.
And then secondly, it's the subsidies. So not having a mandate and not having subsidies, you know, we're going to have some different discussion.
What's the size of the individual and small group market statewide right now?
Mr. Chair, I believe I want to say it's on page.
It's in the business plan.
It's in the business plan.
12%.
And this goes to 90.
On page, Mr. Chair, it's on page 18 of the business plan.
So we have the individual market. You have about, if you count 40, about 225,000, counting both portability and OMIP. Small group market, about 228,000. Remember, the small group is 2 to 50. In 2016, that expands to 100. How many of the large group are between 50 and 100? I'm not sure. So you're talking about 450,000 in 2009.
And do you have an estimate of how many of that 400,000 roughly in the two markets would qualify for a subsidy under the current subsidy model?
I have that because that's our whole financial model is based on that, but I don't have that in my head. Pardon?
I assume it's going to be a very large proportion.
It's a very large proportion.
Mm-hmm. So if there's a subsidy, it would be absurd for those people not to. I mean, these are people who are voluntarily right now in individual and small group coverage. I mean, if they could get a third of their premium paid, it would be crazy for them not to transfer that into the exchange.
Mr. Chair, all you have to do is historically look at the FEOP waiting list or the OHP standard waiting list. There are a lot of folks out there that I think with meaningful subsidies will be coming into this program. And the other question I have, in response to Representative Kenner, is, you know, if the feds back all out of this, I think you've got a bigger problem because you still have 600,000 people in Oregon uninsured, and we don't have any resources to really, I mean, I know that there's politics and all this, but we still got the problem no matter what the Supreme Court says.
Don't beg the money.
Bill?
Go ahead. Well, I'm going to kind of skip to the next.
Yeah, so we were planning to pause here and take any questions specific to the enrollment projections or the financial projections. So I don't know if all those questions have been asked, but if they haven't, we'd be happy to entertain any questions specific to that portion before we move on.
I can tell you Senator Morris, who I don't want to speak for him necessarily, who was very concerned about this issue, told me he was feeling pretty comfortable with what you presented.
Mr. Co-Chair, we did have some discussion with Senator Morris and prior to this, and he is interested in some additional information that will be that we're planning on including in the appendix, but he was happy at this point with how that was laid out and met some of his key questions and needs that he had during the last session.
President Doherty?
Well, this is a comment, but I appreciate in your business plan of going through and having actually a modest amount of enrollees from what it could, because to me it makes the business plan a little more workable, and you're not going to have huge, hopefully, ahas down the road. So I appreciate you, instead of going through and saying we're going to enroll 500,000, which we possibly could, you've got more of a conservative estimate, and the same sort of thing with the overhead and that kind of thing. So my folks in my area are screaming for this. They really are. And I appreciate you having a business plan that is not way out there.
I have a question on the financial estimates. You know what's been on my mind ever since we first started talking about this. Does the 2.5% cover the cost of insurance agents?
No, that is built into the premium in Oregon. It does not include the cost of the agents.
Built into the premium in Oregon? Are you going to do the same model in the exchange that we do in the commercial business in terms of the use of agents?
Well, Representative Greenlee, the price for a product has to be the same inside and outside the exchange. What we hope to do with the agents and in terms of engaging them is, first of all, we want to become basically the appointing body rather than carriers, so that we can control which agents sell or don't sell products through the exchange by requiring specific education certification requirements. So I think that's good, because we can have the agent focused on the customer and the relationship with the customer in the exchange, as opposed to with the carrier. They can sell all the plans in the exchange, not just one carrier that they happen to be appointed with, or two carriers. But the commissions for carriers are a part of the premium dollar that a carrier will charge through the exchange.
So whether an individual uses an agent or doesn't use an agent, they're going to pay for agents? Is that under your plan? Is that what you're planning?
Representative Greenlee, it's not our plan. That's the way administrative costs statutorily are spread in the small group and individual market. If you want to have choice in both, you know, pay it or don't pay it, then I think we have to have some discussion about the regulatory rules around how rates are established and set in the state.
So you're saying all the existing insurance regulations will take place in the exchange, that you won't have a separate set of how you determine premiums and other things in the exchange?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. The federal law requires the premiums charged for plans in the exchange be the same as premiums charged plans outside of the exchange, with or without agents.
That's not what I'm asking. I understand that if there's a bronze plan offered, it has to have the same premium.
Mm-hmm.
But my question is, are you saying that all the insurance regulations of the state are going to be the same in the exchange, that you're not going to have a separate set of determinations on how premiums are determined in the exchange?
That is correct, was chair.
Well, it's going to be very unlikely that I'm going to support a plan that does that. I have to tell you that.
Okay.
I mean, it seems to me if people plan, want to use an agent, they ought to pay for that use of the agent, and it ought to be separate inside and outside. So I don't have any problem with it being the same, but I have a problem with people being charged for the use of an agent when they don't use an agent. And I don't have any problem with agents. I just think people come into that plan and come into the exchange and want to use an agent, they ought to pay for it. And there ought to be a fee, and it ought to be very clear, and they ought to know what they're paying. It ought not be hidden in a buried cost. And I got to tell you, I mean, you heard this in my discussion of Senate Bill 99. I'm going to be very reluctant to support a plan that forces people to pay for a service they don't use. It's absurd. And I think it's absurd in the commercial market, frankly.
So, Representative Greenlee, it is not a decision that we can make. That's a regulatory decision around rate setting and what goes into those rates and how administrative costs are spread by statute and by regulation.
By statute? I mean, statutes say that agents have to be... that you have to pay for agent services in my premium with Kaiser, say?
Well,
I'm paying for agents?
You could be correct. It may not be statute. It may be just insurance regulations. But we can't make insurance regulations. That is DCBS. That's the insurance division. So how rates are established are pretty explicit in statute. I'm not the expert. I'd have to pass it to the insurance folks, but...
Rocky, I got to tell you, that's absurd.
Absurd what my position is, or absurd that's the way it is?
Well,
both.
You just said you don't know whether it's in statute or that, and then you said it is in statute, just right after that sentence. Is it in statute or isn't it?
The rate setting methodology, I'm looking to Senator Shields, who is as much as expert probably on this as I am, but the rate setting methodology is included in statutes, and I believe that then there are the administrative rules that are established by the insurance division as to what can be included administrative costs and what can't. And the example of that is...
rules, you said.
Administrative rules.
And there's something in statute, in Senate Bill 99, for example, that says the exchange is going to follow exactly the same principles that's followed outside the exchange? I mean, I looked at Senate Bill 99, and I never saw that piece.
Representative Greenlee, I think we'd have to look back to truly answer your question about the statute, but the conversation during session was, you know, whether the regulatory function over the insurance industry in the state should stay where it is in the insurance division at DCBS, or whether that should transfer to the exchange. And the decision in 99, as it was laid out, was that function would stay at DCBS in the insurance division. Now, the exchange has the ability to set standards for qualified health plans in the exchange, but I don't think that we have in our regulatory or our statutory abilities the opportunity to change the way premiums are reviewed and set in the state.
Yeah. We better make sure we know that before February. Oh, could you get me your legal opinion? You have a legal staff?
We, Representative Greenlee, we'll ask DCBS and our AG to respond to that question as to whether we have a legal authority to establish different rates based on agent participation or lack thereof. But we'd be happy to do that. But that was a subject, as you well
better,
know.
And enough time for me to prepare an amendment to your LC that makes sure you do have the ability to charge differently for use of agents, because I just think it's a shame. If you're trying to produce value, it's a shame to force people who aren't going to be using agents to pay that fee. That's between 5% and 8% in the commercial market now.
Well, Representative Greenlee, we'll look into that question, and when we follow up with you individually, we'll try and have an answer for you.
So the average, just for one quick, we'll talk about a lot of money. Right now, for example, a major carrier in the individual market, it's $12.50 of a $300 to $400 premium that goes to an agent. So it's not 5 or 8% that over the last 3 or 4 years you've seen the agent commission on individual plans considerably be reduced. Pardon?
It's 4% if it's $12.50 on a $300 premium.
Yeah. $300 to $400 premium is $12.50 for one of the major carriers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the way that my understanding is the way that the carriers somewhat break that out and deal with it is in the medical loss ratio. Is that correct? And so there are comparisons between plans on what percentage actually goes to health care versus administrative expenses. But that, I think, how are you going to set that up as part of the essential benefits, or is that, do you anticipate being able to compare that when you're looking on the exchange and trying to determine which plan is best for you? Will that be listed?
Senator Shields, can you say that again? I'm having a little trouble hearing you. I can hear about every third word.
Probably makes more sense that way. Do you anticipate listing the medical loss ratio of the benefit plans when you're comparing essential benefits?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, the federal government establishes for the individual market that you can have no more than a 20% administrative cost for every dollar in premium. Excuse me, dollar in premium, 20% can go to administrative cost. Almost all kinds of states have tried to get waivers of that. Oregon has not needed because we've always been within that guideline. For the small group market, it's 15%. The agent commission must be within that 15 or 20%. The federal government just received a recommendation from the NAIC. It was a very close vote at NAIC to exclude agent commissions from that, and HHS decided no, that agent commissions needed to be within that 15 and 20% limitation.
Hello, Mr. Chair. My question is, do you anticipate listing what an individual plan's medical loss ratio would be when somebody is trying to determine which plan they'd like to choose?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I think that will be one of the key things that we look at doing, yes. I don't think we have made those decisions, but we've started laying out all the different quality and reporting things that we want to have available for people to look at, and that certainly is one of them.
Go on.
Now we're going to start back at the beginning of the business plan. As Rocky said, the financials and enrollment projections are at the end, and that was really the new information. That was what you haven't seen before. A lot of what's in the rest of the plan, the first 10, 15 pages, are a lot of topics that we've discussed with you at your September hearing and your November hearing. So we're going to go through this part fairly quickly, but again, we'll be following up with you, each of you individually, if you have further thoughts or things you'd like to see in here. There's no executive summary in the business plan yet because we haven't written it. We're going to wait till we're done, and then we'll summarize it for you. I did want to spend a few minutes on the section that we've called the value of the exchange. I think it's important to keep in framework what the potential the exchange has for Oregonians. Rocky went over the mission statement that the board recently adopted, and we have in the business plan a list of the services, a list of the things the exchange intends to provide. First and foremost, it'll be a central place for people to shop for insurance, individuals and small businesses, to get easy to compare, apples to apples information, and grading of plans, information to help people make choices. We'll have a focus on cost and value. The exchange has the potential to help control the underlying cost drivers in the insurance market through the standards that we set on plans sold through the exchange, but we're not going to be doing this on our own. We'll be working with other state-led efforts, primarily through OHA. You heard a lot about the transformation effort this morning. There's lessons that we're hoping can be learned from their work over the course of the next couple of years before the exchange is live that will help rein in the cost of health care.
Amy, if you're following all the regulations of DCBS, how are you going to add any value to this? if all you do is just follow DCBS's work?
Mr. Chair, there are a variety of values that you can add to a health benefit plan that are separate from the regulatory piece of running insurance. Okay, so maybe the value can't be whether an agent is or isn't, we can ask that, but we can require that plans, for example, have a certain percentage of their enrollees in medical homes. We can require, for example, that they don't pay for never events. We can require certain disease management programs or case management programs or coordination of care programs that be in place for individuals. So there are a variety of those kinds of issues that we can put in. The question that's come up is, should the exchange require those? And if they really are that good for the market, maybe they ought to be applied to the entire market. That is, if you're going to require carriers to never pay for, not pay for never events, events that are errors or shouldn't have happened, shouldn't that be a standard throughout the market, not just with those going through the exchange? But there are a variety of those indicators that we hope to add to whatever the federal government does that we think will bring some quality and value.
I don't understand what you just said. I mean, you said before that regulations can only be done because the fees have to be the same in and out of the exchange, that only DCBS can regulate these things. How can you regulate primary care homes for in and out of the market if they have to be the same fee?
Standard of participation, Mr. Chair. If you want to participate through the exchange, 25% of your enrollees or 75% or 50% or whatever it may be, you have to have a primary home care model. Large employers do that
or
now.
There's no difference than agents. We can do. Is that one of the standards you could...
Sorry?
Is that one of the standards of participation, that you can't vary the cost of agents in your premium?
Are you ready?
Would that be a standard of participation?
Mr. Chair, I think that's something we're going to have. You've asked us to go back and look at that. We'll have to do that. I know the focus is on the agent, and that's really important, but the problem that we have in discussing this is the federal law that says the prices have to be the same. So if you change and the prices differ in the exchange, with or without an agent, and it's outside the exchange, they've got to do the same thing. We view that as a market issue. If you want to, we want to put forth a bill that says that this is the way it should be in the entire market, that I think that's fine. We have to be careful from a selection issue and a pricing issue that we have rules that are different in the exchange and outside the exchange as it relates to some of issues around agent participation. That's my opinion.
But other issues that you could create standards that are different inside the exchange and outside?
Mr. Chair, there is no rule in DCBS about quality or value standards that can or can't. That isn't what they regulate. They regulate price and premium.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Financial stability.
Moving along with our list of values, the exchange will also provide us opportunity for seamless eligibility and enrollment processes. So a person will be able to go onto our website or walk into an office or call us on the phone and enroll, shop for and enroll in any type of coverage that they're eligible for. That could be the Oregon Health Plan, that could be through a tax credit for commercial market, or it could be simply, you know, paying the full cost of premium for in the commercial market depending on their income. Our goal is to have it be that they can fill out one application and find out their eligibility for any of those. Oregon is able to get tax credits if they're under 400% of the federal poverty level to help them pay the portion of their premium, and they can only get that tax credit assistance if they purchase through the exchange. I'm going to move along since I think we're running a little bit out of time. Page 5, we have a little bit of a brief history on Oregon's road to the exchange, which covers, you know, really the past decade of work that the legislature has done that's brought us to this point. Was there a question, Mr. Chair?
Is there a question? Oh, yes. President Thompson. Thank you.
At the risk of being counterpoint to my esteemed co-chair, I'm very concerned about this community-based assistance stuff. As an insurance purchaser,
I will go to my local agent where I have my car insurance and my homeowner's insurance, and I'll expect to be able to get professional guidance on purchasing insurance from the exchange. I don't want a community-based assistant coming to my house to advise me on my rights. I don't want the state contracting with Acorn to do some kind of community-based insurance thing. And quite like a good representative, I don't want to pay for any of that. So I would caution that when we get into this community-based assistance stuff, we better know what that costs and who's paying for it. Because I think a lot of people, particularly in rural Oregon, are going to go to their agents, because that's who they're used to going to get insurance, and that's who their employer is going to tell them to go to. There are five agents in town that handle this insurance exchange. Take your pick, and here's your monthly stipend that I'm giving you. Go down to talk to Joe about getting your insurance. But I am very concerned about plowing a lot of money into these community-based assistance programs that are, I think, a boondoggle.
And, it'll be paid for both inside and outside the exchange, right?
No. But I think it's not the cost that we need to look at very carefully.
I agree with you. I just think you ought to pay for the agent's use if you want to use it, and I ought to be able to use the community, and I ought to pay for that.
We agree on something.
Yeah,
we agree on lots of things. I'm just concerned, and I'll tell you, because the community-based assistance thing is coming from the feds, and that's the route to bureaucracy every single time, I can see a 9-volume set of rules coming down on how we're going to train and contract with these people to run all over the sagebrush out there and try to find somebody to sell insurance to. And it's not the way it works culturally here. People don't buy their insurance that way.
Chair Thompson, Representative Greenlick, did you want to go ahead, Rocky?
Yeah. Chair Thompson, Representative Greenlick. I think in the document, if you read that, it's a little bit different view, I guess, than you do, Representative Thompson. We have two very successful programs that we have in this state that have demonstrated great value. First of all, the SHEBA program. I think there's 250, 300 volunteers throughout the state. They don't get a commission. The state, through using federal funds, does provide grants to local community organizations to manage the volunteers and train the volunteers. I actually headed up that program for 3 or 4 years, been very successful. Secondly, we've used the community organizations to really develop what's called application assisters, where we have been able to enroll about, I think it's 80 or 90,000 kids into Healthy Kids. And I think those community organizations have been very successful at doing that. One of the things I've talked with Bruce Goldberg about is when we start talking about the Navigators Community Assisters, the reality is most of the focus of those people are going to be in very low income or in some of them really hard to reach communities. And very often those people will be eligible for Medicaid, not necessarily the commercial products. They are neighborhoods, they are districts, they are out there in the rural areas where agents aren't knocking on doors. And very often they need some help hooking up with an agent or sitting down at a computer and figuring it out. I think I understand the role of an agent, the role of a navigator are going to be different, but I think they're going to be very important to doing outreach in some of these communities and have a lot of the cultural barriers or income barriers to really access health insurance. So a little bit different.
I would go along with you if it weren't for the fact that I have a very rural district served by SHEBA. Most of my district has no SHEBA volunteers. I know that because they call my office trying to find out how to get in touch with a SHEBA volunteer, and we don't have them. We used to have some real good ones, and I know the names of some we used to have were really good, but they went on to complete retirement, and now they're not there. And we're not backfilling, there's no network, it's just, sorry, Charlie, it isn't going to happen for you type thing. And so I see a problem here of balancing what we're going to do in rural communities where we can't maintain these people as a network, and in in going the other way and having so many of them that, you know, there's one on every block, and who cares? It becomes an expense burden and a chunk of bureaucracy that I don't think we need in this program.
So, Representative Thompson, I agree with you on the SHIBA, and that was one of our challenges with volunteers, but I should tell you there's a 1-800 number that you can call, and there are five people sitting at phones who will take calls from any place in the state where there isn't a volunteer, and at least by phone will help folks do that. And I'd be happy to get you that number for your office.
So instead of having a community-based assistance, then you're willing to do five volunteers at a phone?
Co-Chair Thompson, I think you raise really.
I'm all about the rule, guys. You know I'm going to ride you on this.
But you do raise.
That's right.
Co-Chair Thompson, you do raise, I think, one of the big challenges that we face is how do we reach a really diverse market in Oregon? Folks who, you know, are used to working with their agents in small towns, folks who are among the 600,000 plus uninsured who don't have connections with an agent. How do we reach all of them? We have no desire to force people to use a system different than they're using now, but how do we sort of maximize that people know about the opportunities and resources that are available through the exchange? And for some folks, that'll be through an organization they currently get some services from right now. We're going to be spending the next 6-9 months as we talk through our communications plan. Actually, as we develop our communications plan, it's a slide here, and a couple from now I'll show you if we have time, that we'll be fleshing out, you know, how do we reach people? And we don't have the answers yet, but we'll be coming back to
you. I just don't
want
to see a big cost involved, like the cost of agents, that if I'm using the agent, I don't mind paying for the agent, but then I don't want to pay for the community assistance that I'm not using. So we have to find a balance here where we're providing value and not just another bureaucratic organization running around trying to do good at big expense. We don't have the big expense.
Yeah. Why don't we take five more minutes?
Because
we have some panels at one. I want to make sure folks have a chance to get a bite to eat before.
Certainly. On page 6, I want to just highlight that there's a timeline of our major activities over the next 3 years until we're financially self-sustaining. We will be coming out, and as part of the appendices supplement that Rocky mentioned, we'll have for you in January a more detailed operational timeline. We've been hearing from some of our stakeholders that, you know, for their planning purposes, they really need to have a clue of when we'll be needing to make some decisions, some of the major policy decisions over the next 6-9 months. And so our goal is to have that available to you and to them in January. Nope, I've gotten ahead of myself. The business plan also outlines what the exchange is, the value that it will provide for individuals and small businesses through the Small Business Health Options Program, the SHOP program that we've come to talk to you about quite a bit. We've been hearing, Shai, I think at the last meeting, or maybe it was September hearing, we outlined for you the four options for the Small Business Health Insurance Program that we're considering, with our eye really focused on the defined contribution model, where employers can go in and designate either a percentage of premium or a fixed dollar amount that they'd like to contribute on behalf of their employees, and then allow the employees to go into the system and have a choice of plans that they haven't had before. That fourth option, that defined contribution option with full choice for employees, has resonated very strongly with the business community. We've been hearing a lot of support for that, and that's really where we're focused now. We're bringing together representatives from the commercial insurance industry as well as small businesses to think through sort of the technical issues that come along with making that option a reality, but that's really where we're laser focused as we move ahead. Page 12 outlines, you know, one of the things we hope the exchange will do is provide links for information on better health to the consumers who use it. We've been hearing from our Consumer Advisory Committee and others that we don't need to recreate the wheel here. That's why we're calling it Links to Better Health. We anticipate the exchange will be a place where people can go and get directed to trusted information that we know is out there, particularly on how they can best use their health insurance benefits. And then we have our section on the exchange plan requirements and grading. And I'll tell you now that this is a lot about how we envision the process going. We haven't made decisions on what the plan requirements will be or on how we'll grade plans. We're just starting to develop that. We just got the information about the direction the feds are probably going on the essential benefit plans last Friday. And we'll be starting our process in the next couple of months on what the criteria are for qualified health plans in the state. customer service. We've outlined our process there. I think we've talked about the role of the navigators and licensed agents today, but I just want to add we'll also have a call center available for people who either have trouble accessing our insurance through our portal through the internet or just simply don't have internet access or don't want to do this through the internet. They'll be able to call and talk to a live person or walk into the office and get some assistance. Our community customer service and outreach plan is still very much in the early stages. We have our pyramid, our inverted pyramid here, which is really just to show, starting at the bottom, we're in the planning stage right now. We're working with sort of our known stakeholders, building partnerships, starting to address policy issues. And as we move through the different stages toward our launch and then operations of the exchange, we'll be expanding that communications and outreach out until ultimately we'll be working on an educational campaign for all Oregonians and what they can get through the exchange.
On page 16 and 17, we really outlined some of the technology infrastructure initiatives that we started on. As you know, we selected Oracle Systems, which is a configurable kind of Lego-type system to run the engine. We're working with IDEO, which is one of the world's leading user interface design firms out of Palo Alto and San Francisco. Originally developed the mouse for the Mac, in really looking at how people are going to interact with the web portal. They're really good at really saying, if you click here and you click there, you click because you want to get enrolled and you click here, you're now enrolled, how many clicks in between? They really are good at figuring out how to help people navigate web systems and purchasing systems like Amazon and Apple and some of those. So we really, I think, are progressing pretty good on putting these pieces together. We have a governance structure made up of OHA, the exchange, and DCBS, or DCBS and DHS that are kind of overlooking this project.
Sorry. Oh, yes.
Quick question on your tech piece. How off the shelf is the Oracle solution, or are you guys having to then really go in and configure heavily? And on the usability piece, so two-part question, on the usability piece, is there any thought to bring in just average citizen input through that process? I find a lot of the things that the state builds and then publicly posts, like, for example, the transparency piece where you can go look at the state's checkbook, not intuitive and not that the end user understands, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for people, and so people don't go to those sites and look at those things.
So, Ms. Chair, Representative Perry, let me answer the second question first, because it's really kind of exciting. IDEO has done a variety of focus groups in three different states looking at and sitting down and interviewing them really as to, you know, what processes and what they like and don't like in terms of, you know, purchasing or using the internet and their views and values. And I can't explain it, what they do, but people are keeping journals and they really gather all this information. We are one of 10 states that are involved in this project, but they've selected Oregon because we're kind of farther along, I guess, and some of our thinking to really kind of zero in on some of that. So they are very much involved in the research component with the users. They put this on a board and they bring people in and people play with the strings and flows so that they have continual feedback on what they're kind of putting together. So we feel pretty good about the user piece. We also will have our own consultant that is our communication outreach consultant. We've asked to kind of look over our shoulder as we look at some of the work they've done to make sure they're going through the right processes and doing the right things. So we're kind of asking for a professional audit of that process. The other is on the Oracle system. I'm not the technical expert, but it is an off-the-shelf system. So we're not programming from day one. So they've got a system that basically is off the shelf, but it's configurable. You can add components to it. And they're training, they train the state staff and at OHA really in the Oracle framework so that they can configure the Lego pieces and put them in. So what they'll basically be doing is taking this engine that is off the shelf that they've kind of configured to Oregon's needs and then overlaying the IDO user interface onto that. It's pretty amazing to sit down and talk to some of these folks to how they're going to do that. But we think it'll be user-oriented and user-friendly.
And just a quick follow-up. And that, did you guys do then like an analysis to determine that's our most cost-effective way to build those things? I mean, we've got a lot of software transactions that happen in this state, and they seem very clunky compared to
Ms. Chair, Representative Parrish, this went on about a year ago, as you know, when they first selected Oracle, and they went through the vendor selection process and kind of determined that and felt that buying off the shelf was the best way to go rather than building from scratch. You know, the state's history is to build from the bottom, and we haven't always had the best record of that. So I think bringing in somebody who has the expertise at having that base has made a difference for us.
Could you guys wrap up?
I think we can stop there. The appendices of the business plan that you have before you, you know, cover some frequently asked questions, a bit on risk and market-wide selection issues, and then have the membership of our board and consumer advisory committees. And then, as I mentioned, the operational timeline will be a piece that we're adding in. And when we come back in January, you may very well see a little bit more detail on our financial and enrollment projections.
Well, I really appreciate you guys humping as you had to do to get this ready from your committee last week to this. And getting it to us, I think, was very important to do. And I really appreciate it. We are going to recess for lunch. Well, the 1 o'clock panel, please be ready to be here at 1. We're going to actually start at 1. We have a very long agenda. We want to make sure all the people get a chance to testify this afternoon. So we are in recess to readjourn at 1 o'clock.
The Senate is also in recess.